Blog Talk Radio.
Where's my theme? No theme? I don't hear my theme.
No theme.
Nothing. Well, I'm just going to play it myself. Hang on, wait a minute. Let me scroll down here a little bit.
Good morning.
Here we go. We're off to a great start this week, aren't we? This is why I'm so glad you're here so I can do this. All right, let me play this. Hello and welcome to Action Radio. This is Greg Penglis coming to you from the historic district of downtown Milton on the banks of the beautiful Blackwater River. And now let's get into Action Radio. Well, it looks like we're on manual this morning. The automatic is not working, so we're going to use the power shifter to play everything. Fortunately, that's the only thing that actually is automatic about the show. So now I got to go back and check the episodes. I'll check it after check into our sound things after the show. For those that have ever wanted to do radio, this is actually kind of a fun way to get into it because you are your own producer. And then you get to the point where you can't do both because there's just too much to do. And that's why Jane is such a huge addition to the show here. It is, you know, virtual co-host in so many areas as to what we do here. But I've made a bunch of soundtracks, a bunch of things that I like to play just for fun because it's fun, you know. And so you never know what – let me see if I can give you something real quick here. Oh, my God, this is kind of fun. I don't think I've given Jane a round of applause lately. So let's take care of that right now. Here we go. Think so I can just do stuff. So it's kind of cool. So you may have to push buttons too, or I'll push buttons, or somebody will push buttons. But yeah, I can't believe we didn't have a theme. Well, it happens sometimes when we have stuff. It never used to happen, but as we're doing more and more soundtracks and adding things, and sometimes the automatic one doesn't quite work. But I'll fix that. All right. So the title of the show this week: Scandals du jour from President Nobody and the Praetorian Guard. All right. So, I mean, I love the coming up with these titles for the show because I really try to encapsulate what we're going to talk about, at least one major topic of what we're going to talk about. Because sometimes, like today, there's probably about 10, you know, topics. There's so many things going wrong. It's not that Biden is doing one thing wrong. He's doing everything wrong. It's not that the and it's bad enough that the deep state Democrat Republican, the Demgoffs, you know, the Geldings and the Marxists stole the election, but they stole the election and put either a moron or a dedicated communist totalitarian dictator or both, probably both. I think it's a good measure of both. We've sort of discussed the ins and outs of this in the White House. You think, you know, if they were dangerous enough to steal the election, you think they'd be smart enough to put in somebody halfway decent, but no, they put in the moron. So that way they get plausible deniability for everything. So no matter what happens, they can blame Biden and they can do everything they want to do without public accountability. So Obama, Susan Rice, Valerie Jarrett, there's another woman, you know, Obama and his women, you know, the woman cabal, you know, that are running the country right now through Biden, who's the mouthpiece. You know, they're unaccountable. They can do whatever they want, and no one will ever hold them to account. The media won't. The media loves them. They love what's going on now. You know, who is it? One of Obama's either chief of staff or somebody who said the stroke of the pen, law of the land, kind of cool. I remember that quote because it really is so, you know, reprehensible and repulsive to me that someone would actually think that the president makes laws. They don't. The president cannot act without legislation from Congress. No executive order can exist unless it's authorized by a statute duly passed by Congress and signed by the president. In a veto. And so the idea that the president can make laws is just ridiculous. So all these executive orders that are happening now are insane. And plus, they're not working. You know, like I say, bad enough to steal the government and make one work. They've actually stolen the government and make one not work. I mean, everything they're doing is hurting us. Everything. You've got scandals within the administration. The Facebook whistleblower owed $44,000 in taxes. Clinton, the Clinton Treasury Secretary, owed taxes. Now, tell me there's not a little bit of irony in that. So Democrats are above the law as far as they're concerned. They have immunity. And so they don't mind breaking the law and making you live up to it. There was a really interesting Facebook message I found. I kind of wish I thought of it, actually. But let me turn on live chat right now. I got to start doing that earlier. Everything's a habit. And so it takes about 3 weeks to form a habit. So we are here. So Bumper Jack and all the other folks, if you want to get a live chat and type in a message, I'm going to try and watch that a little bit more carefully. And, of course, Gene will be the one immediately responding to you. And then I'll just, I got to keep talking because that's kind of how the show works. Anyway, So that's available to you. But So there was something I was going to say. Oh, I got my little notes here. Anyway, bad enough that they stole the election. And like I said, it'd be interesting if they had someone. Of course, if they had someone halfway competent, then it wouldn't be so easy to beat them in the fall. But the problem is, next fall, that is. But the problem is, I have no confidence that the geldings are going to actually maintain, you know, an honest election, because they certainly didn't in the California election. And that was the test. That was the test for me, because they had a year to think about it. They had almost a year from November of 2020 until now. I guess they held it in September of 2021. So that's almost a year for the Republicans to gear up, you know, to actually make sure that no vote fraud occurred. And of course, they didn't do anything and vote fraud occurred. And so which leads to my belief that, I know what I was going to tell you about. The Facebook post that somebody put, let me just put it here. Why are only the productive people mandated to get a virus injection? Okay. Then you notice there's nobody on welfare. There's nobody on food stamps. There's nobody in Section 8 housing. There's nobody on unemployment when they're perfectly capable of having a job. Nobody who is in the dependent class is required to get a COVID infusion. All right. I call them COVID. I'm going to start calling them COVID infusions now, because they're not vaccines. They never have been. They're basically giving you COVID. That's their purpose. You know, so you get COVID the old-fashioned way, through the air, through contact, things like that. But when that fails, they're just going to give it to you. This is a government COVID distribution program. Let's be honest. From Dr. Fascist, the genocidal sociopathic vaccine drug pusher. And that's what's going on. This is government is in the COVID distribution plan. And what's happening is the non-productive people, the people that are dependent on your tax dollars and are happy to vote themselves more of your tax dollars, which is why I don't think people on welfare should vote during the time they're on welfare. We can talk about that too. But the point is that they're voting themselves your money. You know, government employees who get, you know, outrageous contracts from the government so that they'll vote for particular people. That's another issue altogether too. But the thing is, I wrote this just, let me see my Facebook tweet. I do Facebook tweets. One of the more recent ones, just right before the show, I wrote the messenger RNA COVID infusion is really a national personality test to divide the leaders from the followers. Yeah. Guess who was favored? Okay. So Gina, I'd be curious your opinion on this too, because it really, this is the way it looks to me, because they know, you know, COVID is 99.9 something percent completely ineffective. All right. So we know that. So the idea of going all nuts and calling a pandemic a disease that's 99 point something, anywhere from 0.5 to 0.999 ineffective. I'm not going to say survivable, because that implies that, you know, you're barely getting through this. And most people don't even know they have it. All right. Most people have been exposed, don't know they have it, have immunity, and it's no big deal. Okay. So this is 99% ineffective. So the idea of getting a vaccine that reduces that to 80%, then 60%, then below 50%, requiring another shot, requiring another booster, the quote-unquote vaccine or the COVID infusion is progressively lowering your immunity. Why? Because it's giving you COVID. Okay, it's lowering your immunity at the same time. There's some ingredient in there that has to bypass your immune system in order to teach your body how to make COVID. Because the whole point of your body, if your body left its own devices, would stop COVID from being made in your body. So in the warped logic of the COVID distribution plan by Dr. Fascist, they actually have created a vaccine that's not a vaccine. It's a COVID infusion. It's a messenger RNA that teaches your body how to make COVID, so you allegedly produce antibodies to COVID. Of course, your body's going to produce antibodies to COVID anyway, because COVID is an invasive virus. So the idea that you have to turn off the immune system to teach your body how to make COVID, to turn on the immune system to teach your body how to get rid of COVID, is insane. It's irrational, yet that's what's going on. Okay, that's the logic of the COVID distribution, which means it's not a vaccine at all. It's about distributing COVID. Why? So they can sell more vaccines, because they tell you it's a vaccine, but it's really not a vaccine. I've just been through that. So people get scared. So they get the vaccine thinking they can get rid of COVID when they're actually getting COVID, and the spike proteins are shedding, giving more people COVID, which means more people are going to be afraid, which means more people are going to get the vaccine. It's a self-perpetuating marketing system, or as I'm now calling it, a COVID distribution system from the government. So if you want COVID distributed, you know, government does distributions pretty well sometimes. They distribute money pretty well, from your money, from your wallet to somebody else's, you know, and now they're in a COVID distribution program. I mean, I literally thought of that during the show in the process of discussing this. So this is how my ADHD brain works. But it seems to me that's what's going on. Gene, let me drag you in here right in the middle of a rant. But does any of this ring true, make sense, or, you know, what do you think? I'm curious.
Well, what you are saying, I think, makes total sense. And the thing is, as the government was so interested in getting rid of COVID and that the vaccine really worked, then they would mandate it for their employees too, but they're not. And they're saying that, you know, basically if the governors of Florida and Texas don't get on the bandwagon and start doing what they should about COVID, they have the highest numbers in the country. And my thinking on that is, well, you know what? Who is letting all those illegals into the border or through the border? And how many of those have COVID? And so don't tell me that it's all the U.S. citizens spreading COVID when you're letting, tens of thousands of people each day cross the border?
Mm-hmm. Well, the other thing is COVID definitely spreads COVID. COVID's an airborne disease. You know, everybody's been exposed to COVID.
I was going to say, like I said last week, too, if the Delta variant is from people that have had the COVID shot and get COVID, they say that's the majority of cases right now.
Mm-hmm.
So am I right or am I wrong? I don't know.
No, you're right, because the majority of patients have received the COVID distribution shot. They've received the COVID infusion because their body is now being taught how to make, you know, COVID. And the question we don't know, and this is a Dr. Judy Mikovits question, is the whatever the chemical is that turns off your immune system that allows your body to make COVID from the messenger RNA instructions so you can allegedly develop antibodies to it, does that ever turn off? You know, does your body ever get around that? Or are you actually teaching your body how to make COVID and it's not developing the immune system? Wouldn't that be interesting? See, that's something we don't know. I don't know if anybody knows. You know, we got a rally Tuesday where I'm going to ask, you know, questions like that of some of the doctors. So let me plug that right now. So let me drag up my there's going to be a great rally. I'm going to be there tomorrow. I'm hopefully going to do a Facebook Live video or some kind of live video from this event. It's going to be in Pensacola. It's at Blue Wahoo Stadium, 351 West Cedar Street, Pensacola, Florida, home of the Blue Angels. It will be Tuesday at 6:30 to 8:30. I think it's going to go longer. You've got Dr. Peter McCullough, one of my personal favorites, speaking. Dr. Ryan Cole, I've seen some videos with him. And then you got two people I'm not as familiar with, Dr. Ben Marble and Jana Benham, INL. I'm not sure what that is either. But anyway, this is going to be interesting, put on by Panhandle Doctors for Truth. And so we're going to hear more about that from Jane Adams, who's our medical freedom reporter. She's always on, she's on Thursdays. I've asked her to come on tomorrow morning, see if she can give us, you know, more updates on this. But that's going to be kind of cool. And I might mention that a couple times today. But there we go. So that's what's happening there. So we got a rally. So, but I guess my general question for you, Gene, is regarding this is, and I wrote this here. Yeah, the messenger RNA. Start again. It's morning. I'm not really used to talking Monday. Here we go. The messenger RNA COVID infusion is really a national personality test to divide the leaders from the followers. I never thought about that either until today. But when you look at it, you know, look at the military. The people that are refusing it are the leaders. They're the individuals. They're the people that believe in individual rights. The followers, the ones that are just going along, and the group thinkers, looks like the ones they want. Corporations, same thing. Southwest had to cancel 1,800 flights last weekend because the pilot said, I don't think so. You know, the individuals and pilots, you know, generally are rugged individualists. You know, you can't fly an airplane without the ability to make decisions. That goes with the job. Now, granted, with the airlines, they have very specific procedures. You follow the procedures, but there are times when the procedures don't work. And that's when you need an individual. And the difference between, you know, airplane and the passenger surviving or maybe not is the difference between what the captain can do in a situation where the regulations and the procedures don't cover what's happening. That's where you need a leader, okay? So that's the person you want in the front with their hands on the throttle, pure and simple. And if you weed out the leaders, if you take the – if you make the followers sick with this COVID infusion shot, and the leaders who are healthy kick them out of the airlines, all you're left with sick followers flying the airplanes. I don't think that's a good situation. I'm really happy that the Southwest pilots have had the personal integrity to leave and hopefully correct the situation. I'm sure they'll be hired back. This is the other thing, too, is all these folks that are leaving, they think their jobs are over forever. They're not, because they're going to need you back again. I mean, you can't just pick up trained pilots out of a flight school and say, here's a 737, go fly. It doesn't work that way. Gene, what do you think? Personality test? I mean, it's a new idea for us here at the show.
It would be interesting to see. Yeah.
Hmm. Well, as I said before, if they if they weed out all the leaders, you know, and force the shots on us, all they're going to have left are the followers. And you don't want a nation of followers. It's like when a nation goes to war, the brave are the first ones killed because they're the ones on the front lines of battle. They're the ones doing what has to be done, but they're the first ones killed. So it's really left to the cowards to rebuild the nation. You do that enough times and you get Europe. All right. So Europe has engaged in generation after about every 30 years, they wipe out an entire generation of young men. And so they take out all the leaders. So you look at who you look at World War One and World War Two. The people that rebuilt Europe were the folks, the men and women. Well, some women were fighting in combat in those days, but basically you're left with the men that didn't go. Okay, and so you do that enough times, and you get a bunch of girly men, and you get a bunch of socialist European countries. And I think that's what's happened there. And I think the same thing could be happening here, that they want to weed out the leaders, keep the followers. And that's the way they, because they're happy with that. Why would you bring in illegal aliens? Because illegal aliens are followers. Now, some of them are going to become leaders, and they're going to embrace our country. They're actually going to assimilate, and they're going to, you know, discover the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, and go, you know what, this is pretty cool, you know. And then they're going to join you know, the rest of the Americans, and their fellow illegal aliens who are compliant and passive and followers will be rewarded for that. And the illegal aliens who become leaders, I might even offer them a pathway to citizenship. I don't know. I mean, you know, first of all, go back to your home country and register properly. But what I'm saying is those are the kind of folks we want in this country. And so I don't know how that's going to work out. All right. Do you have a comment on that, or do you want to take on an issue? I have many, many at my disposal here.
You can take on an issue.
Let's do that. Okay. If live chat happens, I have my live chat blocked now because I'm going to be going through some articles here. But so we got some time. Like I said, we got Cassandra at 7 o'clock. I don't think she's going to take the whole hour. In fact, I'm sure probably about half an hour. So we'll get back to issues. If you want to call in, 215-383-3832. This wouldn't be a bad time for that, too. And just now that I know my board works, at least it doesn't work automatically, but, you know, it works. So we'll still be able to play some cool things. I'm going to play Santa Rosa Volunteers from last week also. And then I'll make a new one today for Anti-Federalist number 6. All right. So the first article, I go over these quickly. We've got, in the personalities that truly suck, Merrick Garland. Thank God he didn't make it onto the Supreme Court. And thank McConnell, too. McConnell, you did something right. You kept Merrick Garland, a dedicated fascist, you know, head of the Praetorian Guard at the Justice Department, off the Supreme Court. That was a wonderful thing to do. We got him. We got Francis Collins, the head of the NIH, who mysteriously resigned. I'm going to talk about that. We've got the Senate, which totally wimped out. 12 gelding Republicans, you know, pushed the debt ceiling higher. You got Biden lying on – well, this isn't an article, but do you remember Biden lying on TV? I don't know if you saw the clip, Gene, where he gets on and says, we're not raising the debt ceiling – you know, to pay, this is where we're not, you know, the debt ceiling is being raised to pay current obligations. Of course, that's a blatant lie, you know, because obviously if you can, you know, we can pay current obligations or we'd already be in debt. We'd already have the government shut down. We'd already have defaulted. If you can't pay current obligations, you default. That's just how it works. So the idea that they have to raise the debt ceiling to pay current obligations is just a blatant lie. They're raising the debt ceiling so they can spend $5 trillion more on their stupid Green New Deal socialist communism. That's what it is. And yet he's just out there lying. I think he knows he's lying. I think he's smarter than people think he is. Still has problems, and obviously, you know, but I think he's deranged not because of his mental incapacity, but because he's a truly sick individual that really loves power. I mean, he's an aspiring dictator. He's always wanted to be a dictator. He's always wanted to tell this country what to do. He loves the power. I think he's sane enough to understand that. So his sickness is not mental, but it's really power. Gene, feel free.
Well,
sleep in any
my feeling is the same as far as he's been in government. How long? And name one positive thing he's done.
Are you talking his entire career? Because I can't
his
name any positive
career.
Thing he's done. Yeah. No, he tried to basically high-tech lynch Clarence Thomas when he was being nominated for the Supreme Court. His foreign policy is completely bad. He's voted for every war that I've opposed. He's just a terrible person, and he's run for president several times, and he's always got the same result. So
yeah,
the only
and
way
he
could actually
had to withdraw too at one point because of plagiarism and stuff. Mm-hmm. It's okay, I guess, nowadays to do that.
Yeah. Well, the funny thing was he plagiarized badly. He plagiarized Neil Kinnock, which is the leader of the Labour Party in England. Now, England has like a 2,000-year history. So when Neil Kinnock says, I'm the first, you know, Kinnock in 1,000 years to go to college. I mean, it made sense because, you know, England's been around for a couple thousand years. But when Biden said, I'm the first Biden in 1,000 years to go to college, dude, we weren't in the country until 1776. idiot. He's so stupid. He doesn't even plagiarize well. All right, so then we've got Biden taking his victory lap on unemployment. The unemployment numbers suck. They totally suck. And what's funny is that these people are predicting, oh, we're going to get 500,000 new jobs. See, it's like the opposite. When Trump, with Trump, they say, he's only get 100,000 new jobs, and he gets 500,000, right? And then they condemn Trump, you know. And then, of course, the jobs report comes out that is five times what they expected, and of course, they don't say anything because they don't want to alert people to that. With Biden, they project, you know, 500,000 new jobs are going to be created. Then it's 100,000, and which really sucks. Go ahead.
You know, the sad truth with that, there's so many places like where around my little area that I go to that. Restaurants, different places have to close down because they can't find workers. So there's jobs out there, and you could say, well, they don't pay much. Well, these people or places did not have an issue before COVID finding people to work for them. So why all of a sudden now can they not find workers? Where are all the people that used to work in places?
Well, they're sitting at home, you know, eating bonbons and, you know, barbecuing in the backyard, and they're kind of taking it easy. Yeah. See, the problem is when you pay people not to work, they don't work. You know, what was it Reagan said? If you want more of something, subsidize it. So the problem with work isn't work. The problem is with the unemployment. The problem is with the Democrats paying people not to work and the fact that they actually find this acceptable. So they're saying that people are afraid to work because of COVID. And I put a thing on Facebook saying, no, they're not afraid to work because of COVID. They're afraid of work. They don't want to work. They're afraid of work. They don't want anything to do with work. Well, they're not afraid of it, but I mean, it's just an expression. But they want nothing to do with work. So we got the Treasury Department. We've got we got parents responding to Attorney General Fascist. I got to pick a name for Merrick Garland. I'll think of something. And then we've got Columbus Day. And I got something else here I put on the thing here. Oh, yeah, the face of privilege because a black kid, you know, shot other kids in a high school, it's okay. And he gets to be released that day. But a white kid, especially a white male Christian, it would have been worldwide news, and they'd be calling for the death penalty. So black privilege and black supremacy is alive and well in media, in high schools and across America. All right. So let's get to – that should be an interesting statement. Anybody want to react to that? I'm surprised that didn't make – oh, hasn't made live chat yet. Yeah, I love making these statements just to see who's listening. Okay. So let's go to Daily Wire. Daily Wire is becoming one of my new favorite sources. The Attorney General linked to firm that stores psychological profiles of students and avoids parental consent. So just to let you know what the minister of should we call him like the minister of internal security? Maybe that's a bit long. I'll think of something. So for now, I'm going to call Merrick Garland the minister of internal security. So the minister of internal security is doing some really bad things. And Luke Rosiak, October 7th on the Daily Wire, said more than one-fifth of the nation's largest 100 school districts have contracts with a critical race theory tinged firm co-founded by the son-in-law of Attorney General Merrick Garland, Minister of Internal Security Merrick Garland, who recently raised the specter of involving the FBI, the Praetorian Guard domestic terrorist force assigned to the government, with both guns and immunity. Another thing I put on Facebook. I'm adding to the article. I guess you can tell the difference, right? Anyways, this raised the specter of involving the FBI against parents who express anger over CRT and other issues at school board meetings. So as far as the Attorney General, the Minister of Internal Security, is concerned, it's fine for an illegal alien to chase a sitting senator not only into the women's room but into an actual stall for her protection, and she doesn't get deported. But parents who actually want to, stop Marxism and race and racism, you know, with their kids, they're the domestic terrorists. Well, as I say, the real domestic terrorist is guy. This guy is the domestic terrorist, and his FBI Praetorian Guard. The Praetorian Guard, just to give you a quick thing, Mark Levin alerted me to this. So he's a source of a lot of interesting things that I'd like to kind of investigate and expand upon. So the Praetorian Guard was the secret police. Originally, they were like the Secret Service. They were the guardians of the emperors and various other high officials in the Roman government. And they kind of took on a life of their own, sort of like the Knights Templar when they went crazy. You know, they got a little carried away with their own mission. And so same thing happened here. So the Praetorian Guard became their own political unit. And they got involved in not only guarding the leaders, but picking them and assassinating the ones they didn't like. You know, it's kind of interesting, the parallels with the FBI. Now, I'm not saying the FBI has killed anybody on the way to political office. Well, I don't know. It's possible. But so many people die around Hillary, it's hard to keep track. But the thing is that the FBI, you know, was a major force pulling off the coup d'etat, which installed, the insurrectionist, President Nobody, into the White House. And so the FBI as a Praetorian Guard, I think, is a very valid analogy and a very valid comparison. Anyway, Minister of Internal Security Merrick Garland, head of the secret police, Garland's daughter is married to John, X-A-N, John Tanner, a co-founder of Panorama Education, which issues surveys to students asking if they are feeling gender fluid. Oh, my. Well, then ask, how confident are you that students at your school can have honest conversations with each other about race? So this is propaganda. Students don't care about race. And, well, here's a question, Gene, in your delvings into healthcare and anything you might happen to know about psychology, at what point do people become aware of race? When do people first, I guess, and I know it has to be taught because I went through my school in Australia and I was a teenager. And race never occurred to me. It was never a concept. It was never introduced to me. I mean, I knew there were white people and black people and Asian people and Native Americans and Aborigines and Maoris and all that. I knew people of different skin colors existed, but it never meant anything. I didn't even know there was a classification. So I was completely unaware of race, even though I recognized the differences in skin color. And I'm wondering, at what point are people, maybe it's just this country, because this country is so hyper-race sensitive on purpose. When do people actually become aware of it, and when does it make a difference? Gene, is there any studies on that?
Oh, I'm sure there is, yeah. And the thing is, when it makes, I think any time for a job, college application, or even certainly even some schools, primary schools where you have to put, where you're vying to get in because they're more competitive, maybe private school, that type of thing. But what do they ask? They ask your race. And why do they ask your race? It shouldn't matter. If race isn't a big deal, that shouldn't even be a question on there. But it is because they will, if you're a minority, they will give you that job oftentimes before they will someone in the majority. And usually majority means white males, because sometimes even females can be considered the minority depending on the profession you're talking about or the school you're talking about. And I just think it's sad. It should not matter. It's just like some of the schools that are giving black people more points on their essays or whatever. They're free. Well, I don't even know how much they're doing now with getting into colleges. I think a lot of that has changed since COVID. But they give black people more points and they take more points off of Asian people. Now, does that make any sense? If everybody, what their skills matter, then the people that, if your criteria is a certain thing, a certain get above this score, whatever, then you shouldn't be losing points just because you're one ethnic group or another, or you shouldn't be gaining them because you're one ethnic group. It should go based on what the criteria is and what your skill level is. But it's not.
Well, it's fascinating with Americans of Asian background that initially they were underrepresented in the University of California system, especially at University of California, Berkeley, just because, and what happened that was so fascinating about this is that as the situation increased and more Americans of Asian descent were brought into the University of California system, they established a quota to raise up the amount. Well, then when they exceeded that quota, then the schools brought down the number of Americans of Asian background, because there were too many Asians, in the UC system. There weren't enough, other colors in whatever their salad bowl mix they decided to put in. So whereas the Asian American folks, were screaming and yelling to get up to their quota, they screamed and yelled just as loud, when they exceeded it. Which is kind of fascinating. So that's how it works. Anyway, it looks like, hey, Pianki, call back. We have him on the line for a second. Maybe, if he wants to call back. I'll make room for a phone call. I mean, that's what we do here. But that is quite interesting. All right, let's tackle another topic here before Cassandra gets here at 7. This is from Breitbart. And so Francis Collins. Oh, he's there now. Okay, let's just get him on the line here. Reverend Pianki, good morning, sir. Welcome to another week of Action Radio.
Yeah, I had to call back in because it sounded like it was frying bacon.
Oh, really? Gene, you frying bacon? I didn't hear anything. Nobody told me anything. Well, someone's cooking bacon on my show and they don't tell me?
Yeah.
Jeez. But, Gene,
and I thought you were
I thought I was listening to myself when I just heard Gene make that comment. That's very good, Gene. Very, very good. I'm proud of you.
See the effect you have, Pianki?
You
are our conscience. You are our race consciousness.
Oh, and you know one thing, too? You, Garland's son, and you made mention of the company, I think he has some kind of monetary value in the company that's selling this race theory, critical race theory curriculum.
Well, let me go back to the article. I was going to get on to Francis Collins, another toady of the Biden insurrection. His daughter is married to, XAN, Jan Tanner, co-founder of Panorama Education, which uses, all right, so he's the co-founder. So obviously he's making money off it. He's making, probably as much as anybody's making off it. So yeah. So this is, like I say, it's really great that Merrick Garland did not make it onto the Supreme Court. It's one of the few things Mitch McConnell has actually done really well. I don't think it makes up for all the things he's gotten wrong, like, stopping the vote on the states so they can challenge the Biden insurrection and coup, but he did get that right, so that's a good thing. All right, do you have any more on that, Pianki? I want to throw in a different topic here. And our smorgasbord of shame.
Wasn't Garland pushed by Obama, and when he didn't make it, he started crying?
He was nominated by Obama. I don't remember him crying, but it wouldn't surprise me. Anyway, so like I said, he was what? He just start crying? He didn't get his power. He couldn't unrepresent the Constitution. He couldn't violate every principle this country stands for by being on the Supreme Court. What a shame. Go ahead and cry, boo-hoo little baby.
He didn't get a certificate.
Oh, no. Anyway, continuing on with our scandals du jour from President Nobody. I kind of like that name. Do you guys like that name, President Nobody? I think it really fits. I wish I could introduce my language to millions of people so they could just pick it up and start calling him President Nobody, because that would infuriate the left. I mean, absolutely. It would drive them crazy. Where are the Republicans? Why don't they pick up my talking points? Gene, Pianki, there's something wrong. Most people are idiots. We have great talking points here. We have better talking points than Democrats do. And they don't pick up on them. They just let it go. And I have to, just tell our little Action Radio family, which is growing bigger, by the way. All right, Francis Collins. This is from Breitbart. Breitbart, let me get you a date. Paul Bois, or Boyce, B-O-I-S, October 4th. Francis Collins, director of the National Institute to Give Your Tax Dollars to Their Friends, the National Institute of Health, I misspoke, announced his resignation on Tuesday, just weeks after documents exposed that he made, quote, untruthful comments about U.S. federal funding of gain-of-function research at the Wuhan Institute of Virology, in other words, the Dr. Fascist Chinese weapons, bioweapons cooperative effort with the Chinese Communist Party, also the PLA, the People's Liberation Army. I love communists for their names, People's Liberation Army. It's not of the people. They don't liberate anybody, but it certainly is an army, so they got part of it right. Right. So he says, quote, I love this quote, it has been an incredible privilege to lead this great agency for more than a decade, Collins said in a statement posted at the National Institute to Give Grants to Their Friends. He says, I love this agency and its people so deeply that the decision to step down was a difficult one. No, it wasn't. You're a friggin' liar. Don't lie to me. I'll skip his quote. It said, just weeks before this announcement, Richard Ebright of Rutgers University accused Collins of making false public statements about the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. Hey, who heads up that? Dr. Fascist, right? Grants to the Wuhan Institute of Virology, which have since been proven to fund the study of, quote, chimeric SARS-related coronaviruses, which could infect human cells. Really? I thought that was the whole point. Ebright said bluntly that Collins has not told the truth when asked about this research. Assertions by the NIH director, Francis Collins, and the NIAID, headed up by Dr. Fascist, and the NIH did not support gain-of-function research or potential pandemic pathogen enhancement at the WIV. They are untruthful. Yeah, so in other words, he's a liar. Okay. Now, do you think he's getting out of a sinking ship? Do you think something's about to happen? Do you think something's about to get known? Is there a new investigation out there? Or is he just ducking out to cover his own sorry little ass? What things happen in this guy? Any speculations?
I think it's a little bit of everything, because I do believe that sooner or later people are going to understand more about Fauci's role in all this, number one. And number two, yeah, he's just covering himself, because you don't stay in a position that long. Like he said, well, 12 years is a long time. And so when I first heard that, I was like, okay, what a jab to say something like that when Fauci's been in his position. How long? So basically, if we go by your assumption that 12 years is too long to be in something like that, then Fauci should be long gone. But Fauci still has his own agenda. And we, unfortunately, we don't have the people in – the government that demand the truth. We got people that thump their chest and, you know, talk a good story, but they don't act what they talk.
Yeah, the single biggest mistake Trump made, besides the fact that he let a bunch of Obama people run his administration below the cabinet level, is that he didn't immediately fire and arrest Dr. Fascist and put Peter Navarro in charge of the coronavirus task force. That would have changed everything, because Navarro had 60 million hydroxychloroquine tablets ready to go. He would have stopped this whole pandemic cold in about 3 weeks to a month, maybe. And for minimal dollars, we're talking $20 a person to get rid of COVID. You know, and they spent far more than that. You know, they spent trillions, you know, on the ventilators and the vaccines and everything. They didn't have to do any of it. It all would have been taken care of very simply. Dr. Zelenko knew it. Dr. Mikovits knew it. Dr. Raoult in France knew it. And a bunch of other people around the world knew it. Now even more knowing now. But it was simple to take care of it then. And people don't realize, and I reported this in a previous show, I should probably mention it more often, that the coronavirus task force was part of the Obama pandemic playbook given to Trump during the last few days of the transition. And I believe it was given specifically as instructions to Dr. Fascist for how to take over the Trump administration during the last year of his first term. And you look at everything that happened. I've got my vaccine timeline. We're going to get John Cullen on here this week, hopefully, or soon, as soon as I get a few technical glitches taken care of. But you look at all the stuff that happened, and that pandemic playbook, you know, Dr. Fascist assumed the podium. Trump was standing to the side. Trump should never stand to the side. You know, the president should not be standing to the side and let some underling, you know, run entire briefings, you know, for 2 or 3 hours a day. Basically, he was issuing orders to the governors to maintain the lockdowns. And then you go behind the scenes, and he made that comment. I'll never forget the comment. He says, you know, when he said, I talk to governors every day. Well, why? Why are you talking to governors every day? Who the hell are you, pipsqueak? You're in the NIAID and badly at that. You shouldn't be talking to governors. The president should be talking to governors. And the president's executive staff and cabinet members should be talking to governors. You're an infectious disease person. And you're not even a virologist. I would have fired him for that, too. I would have fired him underqualified. You can't head up the Virology and Infectious Disease Administration when you're not even a virologist. How did he ever get there? Well, politics. All right.
Yes,
comments on that?
Yes,
then
we
move on. Go ahead, Gene. Gee,
he's a yes man. And the thing is with that, people, you, when you get into office, yeah, you should let go a lot of people that are there because you don't know anything about them. They're not in your best interest because obviously they were working for the other person. And you could say even like the military, they're supposed to be non-biased. It doesn't matter who's their chief. Yes, it does. Look at how they're acting. It sure does.
Mm-hmm. Pianki, you want to get in on this? You don't have to.
No, it sounds good.
Okay. All right, let's go to one of my underreported sources. Okay, well, I can do that. You know, that's sort of why I did this. Zero Hedge, one of my favorite sources that I should probably quote more often. So I'm looking for more of the best sources. We're going to get more Daily Wire. We're going to get more probably of the Hill. We're going to get more Zero Hedge. We're going to get Deplorable Patriots. We're going to get some other different sources here as I advance around going through the multitude of things out there. Anyway, this is written by Tyler Durden, and you have a picture of Brad Pitt in his Fight Club, character in position. I'd love to get this dude on the show. That would be fascinating. Probably disguised voice or something. Well, I'll see what I can do. Anyway, so Tyler Durden, and this is get a date here, Friday, October 8th. Senate advances $480 billion debt ceiling deal after 11 Republicans join Democrats to invoke cloture. So let me tell you how this works. So the Senate... they tried to make this a reconciliation bill, and a reconciliation bill was a convenient way that the Senate had of dealing with issues directly related to the Budget Act. So in other words, if they had to reconcile, you know, a budget or regulation or something, they had to reconcile something with the budget, they would use the reconciliation procedure. It was a faster way. It's like a fast track for certain things. The Democrats now use it for anything where they can't get Republican support. So they're completely violating the letter of what a reconciliation bill is, because their bills are standalone. They're not reconciling anything. All right? And so the parliamentarian, people don't know, one of the great unsung heroes of this country right now is the parliamentarian of the Senate, who says, no, it's not a reconciliation bill. You have to get cloture. So in other words, the Senate can debate an issue indefinitely if somebody wants to filibuster it. And the way you stop the debate, so the key vote in the Senate is not the vote on the bill. The key vote in the Senate is the vote to stop the debate. The cloture vote, because once you stop debate, then it comes to the floor for a vote. As long as you're debating, you can debate a bill forever, and then it dies in the session, has to be reintroduced in the next session. Okay, so the Senate and the House are designed to stop bills, not pass them. That's a good thing. Gridlock is a good thing. conflict is a good thing, because the less conflict, the more damage these people seem to do. So Tyler Durden says the Senate has officially advanced the short-term debt limit by a simple majority vote of 50 to 48 after 11 GOP lawmakers joined Democrats in a vote to invoke cloture, okay, achieving the 60-vote filibuster threshold. So listen to how these cowards work. So you've got 10 Republicans, okay, that, well, actually maybe it looks like 11. Well, whatever it is. You have enough Republicans to vote for the 60 votes to cloture. So some 10 Republicans voted to end debate, but then they didn't vote for the increase in the debt. In other words, they wanted to have their cake and eat it too. All right? So they wanted to end the debate because they really wanted the debt ceiling to be increased, but they didn't want to have to run on that. So then they didn't vote for the debt increase, even though they cured the conditions by which the debt increase would pass, because 50 Democrats were going to do it. And then in a tie, party girl. The party girl would come in and cast a vote, and then she'd go back to Singapore or wherever else she's vacationing currently. So the next sentence here, the $480 billion increase will now move to the House, where it could be considered as early as next week. It should be enough to last through at least early December. So kick the can down the road for a few months. Now, the Democrats wanted to kick the can down the road all the way through the midterms, 2022 midterms. That was the goal here. In other words, they don't want a debt ceiling. Well, the whole definition of a debt ceiling is you can't borrow more money. The Republicans only want to hold it back so they can blame the Democrats for spending things that that will make them look bad. So they can say, well, it's not our fault. We didn't raise the debt ceiling. You know, but they're not stopping it for the real reason, which is it's stupid and it's economic treason. And it's a violation of every economic principle to borrow, what, up to $29 trillion right now? That's insane. We already went over this last week. You know, the gross domestic product is, I think, below that right now. All right. One more sentence here, then I'll need to take some comments. This is after Senate Majority Leader Chuck E. Schumer set up Thursday night vote on a short-term debt ceiling increase that would leave the battle to rejoin less than 2 months from now. So they're going to come back and do this again, right? Either right before Christmas break or whatever. In the middle of an already packed congressional agenda, moments ago, a procedural cloture vote, which needed 60 votes, meaning at least 10 Republicans would need to join McConnell in agreeing to concede. Yeah, another surrender. Concede means surrender, okay? Took place, and as expected, amid all the high theatrical drama, not 10 but 11 Republicans voted to join the Democrats. Let me tell you who the economic traitors are. Senators Barrisso, Blunt, Capito, Collins, Cornyn, McConnell, I know that name, Murkowski, Portman, Rounds, Shelby, and Thune. There you go. Those are the usual suspects.
But a lot of those aren't going to be back after next election, correct?
Well, it depends. See, the Senate is up every 6 years. So the House members have to run every 2 years. So the House gets – everybody in the House is up for a vote. But only one-third of the Senate is up for a vote. So the question is how many of those senators are up for a vote? We don't know.
Okay.
That's the question, yeah. And I'm not – we'll find out because we're going to have election reports.
I think Lisa Murkowski is, but unfortunately Susan Collins, I think she just recently was last year I think she was up.
Mm-hmm. You know, and I always wrestle with whether we're better having, someone who's an honest Democrat as opposed to a dishonest Republican.
Right.
Yeah?
You know, we got to add another word to your vocabulary, and it's dumbasses. Because it's what you have.
Okay.
You have a bunch of dumbasses in Congress.
So... How would you use dumbass in the
They use it on the AM and FM stations. So if you're going to be working your way up there, you got to be used to it. It's not a bad word. It tells the truth. And the Congress people, a person that's running for Congress should have a degree in what it is that they're going to be getting involved in.
Hold it. That's brilliant. There's a bill there. Should we require, in other words, if you're in the Armed Services Committee, should you be required to either be in the military, have gone to a military college, or have some kind of history or course of study in military affairs? Same thing with foreign policy, same thing with appropriations. You'd have to have some budget and accounting knowledge. That's a really good question. I don't know if they do. That's brilliant. Go ahead.
Well, they probably don't. Look at your Congress people. I know for good as well that Cori Bush don't have no degree in understanding how the politics work and how the procedures work and how legislation and so forth is passed. They don't. So that should be a requirement, because that's what you have up there when it comes down to things like this, is a bunch of dumb butts.
I wouldn't necessarily say a degree because I'd be a hypocrite if I said they had to have a degree. I think if you demonstrate knowledge, for example, all the things I do here that I don't have a degree for, I don't have a law degree yet. I'm writing legislation. Same with you. Unless you have a law degree you didn't tell me about. But I don't have a law degree. I don't have a communications degree. I don't have a broadcast degree. I don't have – what else don't I have? I don't have an English degree, and I write articles all the time.
Greg, let me ask you a question.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you a question. Do you do a lot of studying on your own?
Oh, hell yeah. You know I do.
Well, then you got a degree.
Oh, I see. Okay. That's a good way to look at it. I'd say required degree or knowledge.
And it's just good to demonstrate that they know what's going on. And apparently they cannot, because when they're sitting in the seat and mm-hmm. we see this type of action coming out of representatives, then it shows that they don't know. It's the same thing with this virus. A lot of people mm-hmm. don't know, and they are afraid. And that's just a reflection of the education that they have had in their life.
Yeah, I'm just writing stuff down here. Yeah, I'm going to put this in my – I have 160 bill ideas right now that I haven't started, just to let you know how much work we have left to do.
And they should – I think yeah. they should have an ethics course, and if they violate it, boom, kicked out. There shouldn't be any discussion. Just you're fired. You know how –
Well, there's
– you know
they
how
already have an ethics.
A lot of states have yeah. jobs where anybody can be fired at any time. I think this mm-hmm. should apply to government. If they do something that's unethical, boom, out. You know, because that way, make them sign a piece of paper, because so many of them are unethical. What they
yeah,
do.
There's already an
no
ethics committee.
Back. Nobody should get a kickback.
Well,
yeah. Here's the problem.
Well, it's the same thing with voter education.
Yeah.
It's the same. You hear these conversations about voter education. You know, it's one thing to be able to go in and cast a vote for names that you recognize because they've been talked about or someone has told you. But it's another thing when you go in and when you take the time out to research a candidate and what they stand for, what they have said in the past, and how they have acted. That's voter education. Voter education is not being able to go in and punch alongside of a name that's familiar with you.
I want to put one caution in when it comes to ethics. There already is an ethics committee and there are ethics rules. The problem is you always have to be on guard that the majority won't use whatever your program is to oppress the minority. For example, the dictator of the House, Nancy Pelosi, refuses to let Republicans even propose an amendment to any bill. They're not heard. They can't schedule a hearing. They have absolutely no power. Okay, and that's actually in the House rules. That's why the whole idea of a party is so abhorrent to me when it comes to Congress. But if you let the majority determine what the ethics are, I mean, I'll tell you right now, Devin Nunes would have been thrown out of Congress, who ran the Intelligence Committee, Jim Jordan, Matt Gaetz, any of the people who are controversial at all would be thrown out. They'd make up ethics violations charges against them and toss them out. So you got to be really careful. In other words, be careful what you wish for when it comes to politics. You got to consider what's going to happen if the other side is in charge of whatever you're doing. It's like executive orders. It's great to be able for Trump to be able to have erased the things that Obama did, but now you notice that President Nobody has erased everything that Trump did and made everything worse. You know, so the power of I would limit the power of executive orders. I mean, say where in the Constitution do you have the authority to do this, and which specific piece of legislation are you operating under with this executive order? Now that would restrain all presidents from both parties, you know, in a way that I don't think could be taken advantage of as easily as what's going on right now. Okay, let me switch again. We got about 5 minutes. I think I can get one more issue in before we get to Cassandra, who's going to tell us. She's got some fun things. We got a ghost walk. I want to find out about that. I've been asked to participate, but I just show commitments have kept me from doing that. But we'll find out about that and other things going on in Milton. Because Milton was the first city to hold a Mardi Gras parade while everybody else was still in masks and lockdowns, you know, from New Orleans through the Gulf Coast, Mississippi, Alabama, and all the other places. All right, Town Hall. Town Hall, Spencer Brown. Post this October 8th. Biden takes bizarre victory lap on worst jobs report of his presidency. So here's yet another screw up by President Nobody. This is nearly 90 minutes late to an address in the September jobs report. President Nobody either doesn't understand the harm that his policies have caused to the American economy, or he's hoping you don't know any better. Despite the worst jobs report of his presidency dropping on Friday, Nobody spoke positively about the latest unemployment numbers. I'm good at that, just putting Nobody in for Biden. It's really kind of fun. right. Anyway, Jason Rentz on KTTH Radio says, despite the horrific jobs report, President Nobody is actually celebrating and bragging this morning. Insanely bizarre speech and tone. Okay, speaking furiously, Nobody attempted to claim that the sub 5% unemployment rate was proof of his, quote, Build Back Better agenda was working, but failed to recognize that September's report missed predictions by 60% and 300,000 jobs. I don't think oops or my bad particularly covers that, but that's really what they're saying. President Nobody claimed that Americans shouldn't pay attention to September's numbers, the second month in a row in which new payrolls missed estimations by a significant margin because the numbers bounced around. There we go. And then we get another from townhall.com. President Nobody explains away his disappointing September jobs report by saying that the monthly totals bounce around. But if you take out the trend, it's solid. The trend is down, you stupid moron. Back to the article. Instead of the 500,000 new payrolls experts forecast, see, there's experts, okay? You think government experts are experts? Government experts are agenda-driven. They're propagandists. They pick their conclusions, and then they're trying to find supporting evidence. And when things don't work, they have to explain away why they totally screwed up. Okay? They figure that the expectations will create the results. It just doesn't work that way. All right. Let's continue. This is here we go. Instead of the 500,000 new payrolls experts forecast, just 194,000 were reported by the Bureau of Labor Statistics on Friday. See, those folks are good. Okay, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, they're good. They actually do report the real figures. What's done with the figures is something else. Anyway, and Fox News' Dagan McDowell pointed out that the only reason the unemployment rate decreased is due to Americans leaving the labor market and no longer looking for work. Okay, let me explain that. There are about five measures of unemployment, maybe six. There's I think it's six, because there's U6 through U1. Okay, the figure that you have reported is the most optimistic, rosy scenario. It's called U6. And the way they establish U6 is they do a survey. They actually call people up and find out. You know, then they ask two questions. You know, do you have a job? Yes, I do. Okay, great. Or if you say, do you have a job? No, I don't. Are you looking for work? Okay, this is what determines the U6 rate. And if you answer, yes, I'm looking for work, well, then you're classified as unemployed. Because you don't have a job, but yet you're looking for work. Okay, so now you're unemployed. If they ask you, are you looking for a job, and you say no, then you're not unemployed because you're not in the labor force. You're not looking for work. So you won't, even though you don't have a job and you're of eligible age to work, you're not counted in the U6 unemployment because they only count people that are looking for a job. It's a bogus figure. It's reported all the time. The real unemployment rate, if you go to Shadow Stats, you'll find that the real is, or take a look at the other unemployment rate. Hey, Gene, can you do that for me? Not Shadow Stats, but look up, if you can look up the various U rates, U6, 5, 4, and 3. See if you can get the total unemployment picture. Let's get a couple of numbers on this. Pianki, you're going to do that too, because you're really good at numbers too. So let's find out what the various U rates are. And I'll go through a little bit more of this article, and then I'll move on to something else. Then, of course, we can come back to it. Let me see. Here we go. The president also attempted to skirt blame for the insurrectionist also attempted to skirt blame for the dismal data by blaming the Wuhan coronavirus, something he pledged as a candidate he would end because he had a plan. I remember that when President Nobody said, I'm going to end coronavirus. Yeah, right. Rather than his harmful policies, such as extended unemployment benefits that incentivized Americans to stay home rather than return to the workforce. So the unemployment numbers are all skewed. Okay, because they're paying people not to work. So when they ask the question, are you looking for work? Well, no, I'm living on unemployment. I'm doing great. So they've actually increased the amount of people that will not be counted in unemployment. Let me say that again. They have increased the amount of people who will not be counted because when those people are asked, are they looking for work? We'll say, no, hell no. I've got unemployment lasting another 6 months. Why should I look for work? Okay, so that totally skews the figures. So anyway, we'll wait for Gene or Pianki, whoever feels motivated to get back. I'm going to check live chat and see if we have any. Nope, nobody yet. I think it's a little too early. Bumper Jack seems to want to join us in the 7 o'clock hour. All right, let's move on to another one, unless we have a comment from Gene or Pianki in terms of the bizarre jobs report. Going once, going twice. Hearing none, I guess you're all looking up figures, which is great. That's, you guys are so good. I really appreciate your help. Seriously, I could not do the show without help. I couldn't. Yeah. Gene, what do you got?
I just got one for August on the U6 rate, and that's August is 8.9%. July was 10.1%. And then if you look back a year ago, it was 16.8% when they were in the throes of the lockdown.
Yeah, see, these are artificial economies, but it's interesting that it was 10% last month, 8% this month.
That's what it says, 8.9% in August, yeah.
Yeah.
Let me see what else has come.
Yeah, if you can get different ones besides U6, or if you can get the definitions of the unemployment measures or something like that, it might take a little digging, but I think it's worth it. This is a good time to explain that so people understand exactly what's going on, that the people are being paid not to work, and the unemployment's a lot higher than they're telling you. If they're saying 5%, you know, U6, and maybe it's, you know, 15% U5 or 4, you know, you should know that. Because the way they used to measure unemployment before Clinton changed the way they measure unemployment, that's the thing too. The Clinton administration, you know, cooked the books. They didn't like the scenarios they were being given, so they changed how unemployment was measured. So what in the classic method, which is the difference between the total labor force, in other words, everybody who's eligible for a job, and the percent of people who are working, that's the real unemployment rate. Is the labor force, the capacity, the people that are eligible, you know, of working age, you know, between 18 and 65, right? So they classify that as like the labor force. And the percentage that's not working, that's the unemployment. Well, during the Depression, it was about 25%. During the Clinton, you know, when the economy sucked because of all the socialism, it was around 20% or something like that. So, and Obama's was pretty high too. Obama's was up like 15, 20%. Real unemployment, not made up unemployment. So the only real measure of unemployment is the one you never get. It's the difference between those that the workforce, the age of work, you know, 18 to 65, and the percentage of those people that actually are working. That's how they do it. All right, Gene, do you have something?
Yeah. Gene
first, then with Jackie.
U5. Yeah, the U5 is 5.6% in August, in September. August was 6.20%. July was 6.8%. June was 7.2%. So it's actually down compared to what it had been the last few months before that.
Okay, what's U5? Did it give you a definition?
No, I just put U5 in because I don't know what any of that is.
Okay, well, you know.
Let me look what U5 is.
So if you get definitions for them, because that seems to be a lower rate, I'm curious why. In the meantime, Pianki, what you got?
Well, on DebtClap, it says that the official unemployed is 8.4 million. Actual
right.
unemployed is 14.3 million.
How do they measure actual?
Well, actual unemployed is people that's not in looking for work, retired, and so on, so on, so on.
Uh-huh.
Official unemployed is those who are looking for work but cannot find work. U.S. workforce now is 153.3 million. In 2000, it was 159.4 million.
Huh. So we're increasing our population and reducing our workforce. Oh, that's brilliant. Social Security is going to love that. So 153, the current workforce is, hang on, let me get my calculator here. So how many in the workforce?
The current U.S. workforce is 153,250,706.
Well, let's just divide 153 divided by 330 million people, and you get 46%. So less than half the people in this country are in the workforce. 46%. So the labor rate is 46%.
The population is 332,748,512.
Okay. So, I mean, you know, obviously of the 46%, a lot of those are retired folks and kids. We're not counting them. So you take them out, you still got millions of people eligible to work who aren't in the workforce. You know, you take the population between 18 and 65, that's a pretty high percentage. Now, I'm not saying all people have to work. I'm not saying that, especially parents that want to stay home with their kids, you know, that or people that are working in home businesses or things like that. You know, it's definitely raising a family's work, you know, every bit as much as you know, working for a company, working for a paycheck as opposed to working for your family, both of which are going to make you richer in different ways. But the point is that, you know, they are eligible and they are part of the labor force, whether they choose to be in it or not. So it's just interesting that of all the people in this country, less than half are actually doing the work and creating the wealth that everybody else is living on. I just find that interesting. All right. A couple minutes, then I think Cassandra's already on the line. So I'll tell you what I'm going to do. So we're going to hold up for a little bit here. I'll get to the Treasury. Go ahead.
In one of your shows, we need to talk about the Black Cow Rittenhouse in Texas.
Oh, sure. Do you want to talk about that sometime? You want to schedule some time for that?
Yeah. Sometime today we'll talk about that.
Okay, sounds good to me. All right, so for Cassandra, I don't really have a theme for her yet. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to play this Milton promo I made very early. And it's a little bit long, but it gets the message across. And I think I've already sent this to Cassandra too. So I'll be right back. This is Greg Penglis, creator of Action Radio for my town, Milton, Florida. Milton, it's where I live. It's where you can live too. It's where you can bring a new business, especially a business that helps our downtown historic district. We have everything in Milton. We have the Blackwater River. We have the Imogene Theater, built in 1912 and still booking national acts. We have Scoop's Ice Cream. We have Boomerang's Restaurant, where I get my favorite Thai chicken pizza. We have an outdoor stage for music acts and free concerts by the river. The Blackwater Bistro will keep you in steak and seafood indefinitely. We have brew pubs creating great craft beers and giving us all a place to relax and talk. But it's more than just stuff and food and buildings. It's people. Remember the show Cheers, where everybody knows your name? It's that kind of place. So if you're tired of the cities, of the traffic, the frenetic pace of life that doesn't seem to get you anywhere, if you want a small city that has incredible potential, that combines the best of historic buildings and modern, fun, small retail shops and restaurants, and a great waterfront, plus who knows what for the future, take a look at historic Milton, Florida, in the Panhandle, near Pensacola, and the world's greatest beaches on the Emerald Coast of the Gulf of Mexico. Milton is going through a renaissance. Maybe you can be part of making it happen. Yeah, I had fun making that, and it's all true. In fact, I think I kind of like that for your theme. Cassandra, what do you think? Can you handle that?
I like it.
Okay, well, good. So now we're all in a festive mood over our wonderful city here. what's going on? What's happening in town?
Well, let me start with what did happen
okay.
on Saturday, because we really had a big weekend downtown. The West Florida Railroad Museum, which is also the L&N train depot downtown on Henry Street, we had a fall festival, and we were packed. We had Cruz's Crepes out there. They have savory crepes as well as sweet crepes. And then we also had the Shaved Ice food truck, and people everywhere, you know, free train rides on the kids train in the back on the Jordan lot. And it was nonstop from 10 to 3 yesterday. I ended up having to stay right at the entrance, literally directing traffic and parking people all day long. It was
great. Wonderful. Yeah. Do a lot of folks know about this?
And
they drive past it, but I'm just wondering if people actually know that there's a museum there. And I've been over. In fact, I actually owe those folks a big apology, because I wanted to have them on the show, and I meant to get back, and I got, you know, kind of crazy. So if you want to bring them on the show anytime with you, feel free.
Okay.
This is a great thing for us. Yeah. Okay.
And what you mentioned, unfortunately, in any community, and it's even harder to believe in a small community. Yes, people become blind to what they, you know, just drive every day. Or they might look over and say, oh, that's neat. I've never been there. I need to go there sometime. And yes, it was down for, you know, part of last year because of COVID, but it's open Wednesday through Saturday, 10 to 3 every week. And if you haven't been, you really need to come, because there's a lot of history, a lot of education, a lot of cool stuff, model trains. And if you are a model train enthusiast, this coming Saturday, they're having a swap meet. And I believe Dadgum Good Barbecue is going to be out there for this weekend. So that's a cool thing that people can come and, you know, swap, trade out, pieces and parts and train sets with each other.
No, the barbecue people, is that a food truck? I love food trucks.
Oh, they have amazing barbecue. Yes, they are
okay.
a very good food truck.
So when are you doing the food truck competition? The Milton, first annual Milton food truck competition. Oh, come on. What do you think? You like that idea?
We could maybe. The big deal is the city council several months ago, they put a moratorium on the food truck ordinance. I was against the food truck ordinance and the way that it was written. But right now, we are enjoying the moratorium, which has made it possible for some of the businesses downtown, but also, you know, the West Florida Railroad Museum. You know, we've been able to have food trucks out there. And that is, you know, really nice for people, you know, that come to visit. Plus, it is an attraction.
See, I love food trucks. I remember in San Francisco, which is so busy and it's so expensive to open a restaurant there, these food trucks would come in and they'd race into the downtown area, you know, from like 11 to 1 and then go. And all the people that perch out on the fountains, you know, it's huge. So here in town, I mean, it's not a huge city, but we could, you know, as you get food trucks, the food trucks will bring in other restaurants because people will get used to coming downtown for food. And so then you get the fixed places.
Not everybody. Yeah, timing is everything, though. And so, especially in the beginning when we only had, you know, one or two restaurants. So just like you said, the food trucks come racing in and then they pack up and leave. And you have your brick and mortar restaurants who are supporting huge overhead. You know, you can be in a point where it's not really fair to allow the food trucks to come racing in, like you said. But what is allowed right now is as a support to a brick-and-mortar location, but also if someone wants to develop, for instance, a food court, you know, downtown or a food truck park or something like that, right now, you know, you can do it. But I want to back up and tell you about the Panhandle Butterfly House, because they were also open on Saturday, and it was their first event. You know, they're in the Jones House, the historic Jones House, just catty corner to the Railroad Museum. And they did a big tag and release event for the monarch butterflies, and they released 200 butterflies.
How do you tag a butterfly?
With, you know, kids participate. Unfortunately, I was directing traffic, so I didn't get to go over there and watch it myself. But they literally put a tiny tag on the butterfly, and this program is through, I believe they said it's like the Kansas Extension Center. I'm not sure why it wasn't our local extension.
Yeah, Santa Rosa
Center,
is a great extension. Agricultural place. Yeah,
but through this. Yeah, but through this program, they will actually be notified if these butterflies make it to Mexico.
Well, they have a little tracker on it, a little GPS or what? This is great. Yes, we've GPSed the butterflies.
Like I said, unfortunately, I went over there very early, and I helped them set up. I got to speak to one young man that had one of the educational setups, and I learned about, you know, good bugs and bad bugs. And I have to share that I never knew how helpful wasps are to your garden.
Yeah.
So there's a really bad moth. It's a big brown moth. I don't remember the name of it. But the wasps will lay their eggs on that, you know, caterpillar while, you know, while it's doing its thing. And, you know, if I open up my doors for the cool air or something, I'll get those brown moths, you know, flying in. I didn't know that they were so bad. But anyway.
Oh, yeah, no,
the
moths aren't bad. It's the caterpillars.
They were
packed. You know, from what I know about bugs, and I used to study bugs as a kid, I'm not going to go into details of what the wasps do. I mean, the wasps do control the caterpillars. The way they do it is disgusting, but it's nature, and it's kind of horrible.
Yeah.
So, you know, we hope that the caterpillars don't have a well-developed pain system. But it's pretty awful.
Yeah,
but wasps are essential. Yeah.
I literally just noticed like three wasps' nests on one overhang of my house, and
well, those are different.
You know,
those are paper wasps.
I don't know yet.
Yeah.
It'll make me think twice, though. I'll have to check them out before I, you know, get out the bug spray.
Well, If you do some research, but if you've got someone who's allergic, that's a whole different thing. You have to get rid of them. But the wasps that you're talking about are not the ones that are controlling the caterpillars. The paper wasp, the hornets, yellow jackets, things like that, they're real self-serving. but there are individual species of wasps. And what's interesting about nature is that the certain species have evolved for one particular caterpillar or one particular spider. You know, like there's a tarantula wasp that kills only tarantulas. By laying eggs, you know, on them. And there's a cicada wasp, and they're very specific as to how they do this. And the population of wasps is regulated by the population of prey. It's a very interesting prey-predator relationship. So if the wasps kill too many caterpillars, the wasps die out because there's no food for them. If the caterpillars get too big, then you have explosion in the wasp population.
Yeah.
So yeah. Yeah.
Yeah,
just ask. I know stuff. I don't know why.
Yeah.
Stuff in my
head. I will want to identify that wasp because, you know, for me, I'm really into plants and I have a lot of, you know, plants and vegetables, things like that. And, you know, nothing makes you madder than when all of a sudden all your tomatoes are gone.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So. Well, the thing to do is bring in ladybugs because ladybugs eat aphids. Ladybugs only eat aphids. Ladybugs are very specific. And again, the population, if they eat all the aphids, then ladybugs die. If the aphids explode in your population, you're going to breed a whole lot of ladybugs, you know. So it's a self-regulating system.
You see those, and you see those ladybugs fewer and fewer, kind of like the green frogs, because now we have some killer frog out there that's eating all of the green frogs.
Yeah, invasive species are the one of the biggest problems. And moths, you know, they come in on ships, they come in on airplanes, they come in when, you know, the Department of Agriculture, which used to be at the airports and then the seaports, now it's Homeland Security. The government in their economizing, they took away the usual. When you used to come into the United States, there were three departments that were responsible that you had to go to. You had to go through immigration to make sure of your citizenship. You had to go through customs to make sure you weren't bringing in bad stuff. And you had to go through agriculture to make sure you weren't bringing food, pests, things like that. Well, they combined those into customs and border protection, and they made I know this because I briefly served in customs after 9/11. I was one of those volunteers, kind of like one of those Band-Aid people, until they trained an entire series of younger super agents with, you know, I had like 9 weeks training and they had like 9 months. And so the super agents were immigration and agriculture officials all in one, which is kind of stupid because each one of those is its own specialty. Anyway, they tried to economize, but the problem is they're not, I think, regulating the agriculture as much as they should. And so that's one of the things that lapses. And so you get invasive species. The other extreme, of course, is like the Burmese python, which is an invasive species, but that was brought in through the pet industry, which was kind of stupid.
Yeah.
But things like moths, gypsy moths, which and there's certain things. There's some orange. There's like fungus get brought in, too. There's like something that's devastated our Florida agriculture. And we should do a show on that, too. But a lot of times there's a wasp that gets the parasites. And there's like very tiny wasps for very tiny parasites. It's a fascinating study. I don't know how we, you know, it's kind of interesting to talk about this.
Speaking of the plants, I want to tell you about the Garden Club, because they have an event this weekend. The Milton Garden Club. They're at 5256 Alabama Street.
Okay.
And they are having a plant sale and kind of a flea market, you know, type of a sale also, and that's from 9 to 1 this Saturday on the 16th. So they had on their Facebook page, they had given a description of, you know, some of the, you know, types of items that will be for sale. So, and it's an indoor event also. So, you know, it doesn't matter if it's raining or not, which I think it's supposed to be, you know, nice weather. And then the following weekend we have Ghost Walk. And that is going to be on the 22nd and the 23rd. And I just want to tell you, this is not a trick-or-treat event. This is not a scary haunted house, you know, type of an event. It's very family-friendly. And you go on a walking tour. First, you start at the Imogene Theater. And
which has ghosts,
we show,
by the way.
I'm sorry?
It does have ghosts, by the way. I'll tell you that story when you're done.
Yeah. So upstairs on the theater level, we will be showing Hocus Pocus, and that's kind of where we, you know, corral everybody while they go out in groups with an individual tour guide. I think we have about 11 stops this year, but we do have a nice It's actually the shortest route that we've ever had. So if you've ever been on the tour before and thought, oh, my God, you know, it's so far. We've had some that were long enough that they went over to the depot and we had to bus them back. So we have listened, and this is a much shorter route. But you start at the Imogene, and you go basically through downtown. We're on the north side of Caroline Street this year, and we'll end up back basically at the Imogene on the west side of the building. The Blackwater Pirates will be there, and they will be, you know, reenacting a, you know, a historical skit. And that is what happens. You have people in costumes at each one of the sites, and you learn the history of either events that occurred at that site or, you know, about the family, that type of thing. And then just next door after the Pirates, you'll walk over to the Presbyterian Church, and that's where we serve, you know, refreshments at the end. And that's the very, you know, end of the tour. But very popular. I think this is year 21. We couldn't do it last year. It's been an annual event for over 20 years, except for last year due to COVID. So we're very happy
COVID,
to put it on this year.
You know how much I hate all the COVID nonsense, the
well,
virus that really ended.
Well, the
virus is a reality. What I'm saying is that the response to it was horrible.
No, what I'm saying is the volunteers, we, first of all, the theater was shut down during, you know, October of 2020. So can't have people at the theater, which is what it's centered around. And there's no way that we could get the volunteers, which it takes a lot of volunteers to put on this event. And frankly, I was a little concerned for this year. People missed it last year, and we have a great, you know, team that has stepped up to, you know, really help organize this event. We have meetings every Wednesday and Thursday for the volunteers that are actors and tour guides, and we even have a couple of our key people that are meeting people by appointment on some Mondays and Tuesdays if they can't, you know, make it to the other meeting. So this is a huge group effort, and we are really excited. It's our main fundraiser of the year. So, it kind of hurt to not be able to do it last year.
Oh, no, I'm with you. I'm not criticizing you. I'm not criticizing the ghost walk. I'm criticizing the policy, because I think a lot of the policy, you know, even though it is definitely a real virus, and it's caused some real tragedies. But what I'm saying is the response to it was so overblown, so insane. We've talked about that enough on the show. I don't have to go into that again. But the point is that I'm glad you're back. I'm glad you're doing it. So no masks, no requirements, no lockdowns, no 6-foot nonsense, none of that stuff, right? This is just a ghost walk, right?
Nope. Everything is optional except for coming into the theater. You know, when you start out, it's basically an outdoor event, but anyone is welcome to wear masks. It's not.
Oh, yeah, I never stop people from doing
but,
it.
But you just do whatever.
It's the mandates.
You know, whatever you feel comfortable with. Yep. And we're hoping this week, you know, if you follow the Santa Rosa Historical Society Facebook page, I'll be announcing this week the locations where we can finally start pre-ticket sales. I'm just waiting for those tickets to get back from the printer, and they are beautiful tickets. They look a lot like our poster that we have been, you know, sharing on Facebook.
And for those who are wondering,
the ghost walk,
Okay, I was just going to say that for the folks who are listening across the country and various places, from New Zealand to Japan to Argentina to England, the reason we talk about the local thing, I'm based here, and these are my friends, and also that I'm hoping to inspire people in your town. If you have a historic district, if you have an old theater, if you happen to have a river running by your town, if you happen to have an old building like a courthouse that we're hoping to turn into this wonderful market, if you want to bring in new business, if you want to preserve your history, and something Europe's really good at, for all those reasons, I do this. I'm not just doing this to talk about Milton, but we're a microcosm of what any historic district anywhere in the country can be and hopefully will be as we progress and we try things out and we improve our situation here, you know, I hope that these ideas will inspire, you know, people across the country, especially in areas where they may not, you know, newer areas on the West Coast that don't have as long a history. You know, you got towns there, you got businesses, you know, established, you know, 2010, look at our long established, you know, track record. So, wait a minute. You know, you got places in New England that go back to 1600, you know, and places in Florida that go back to 1600.
Right.
So it's a very different
right.
thing, but I'm just saying that there's a relevance to everybody for what we do here. Yeah.
Right, right. And history matters. Your heritage mm-hmm. matters. We are, you know, a young country, but as, you know, the National Trust for Historic Preservation has trademarked, this place matters. And they do matter. And unfortunately, just like we will continue to battle, you know, the potential four lane through Highway 90, which would ruin our downtown, you know, these places in our downtown matter. But the reality is you have people that live just, you know, outside of the city of Milton. All they care about is their commute. They want to get from point A to point B as fast as they possibly can, and mm-hmm. they don't care about, as they put it, you know, the old buildings or whatnot. But mm-hmm. with all my years of not only, you know, dabbling in historic preservation, but being with, you know, the Main Street America program, I can tell you in traveling to different areas, they say do not lose your theater downtown, your historic theater. And mm-hmm. we are the Imogene Theater is the only historic theater in Santa Rosa County, and I've seen in other communities where they've let it turn into a Starbucks or offices or something like that, and you do not want to lose your performing arts theater. Same thing with the courthouse. It would have been nice. The courthouse could have been developed, kept downtown and developed mm-hmm. in a certain way where it actually would have contributed in mm-hmm. a better way, but now that the decision was made for the courthouse to the courthouse function to move, we have to take a serious look at what's going to happen, what adaptive reuse plan, mm-hmm. because you have some people that, you know, they'll just, oh, tear it down. You know, they don't really know anything about it, but that's what they'll say, especially yeah. in this climate of what construction prices are like, what lumber prices are like. But, you know, that's what we're constantly dealing with. But, you know, I don't want to go down that path because I want to also be able to tell you that the city of Milton is putting on a fall festival on the 30th.
Yay.
You know,
all
we
right.
used to have Pumpkin Festival down on Willing Street, and mm-hmm. That group, it's a small group of business owners on Willing Street. They decided due to COVID, they didn't want to do it this year. So the city of Milton has stepped up to the plate, which normally the city has given them money for sponsorship to put the event on. But since they're not doing it, the city council voted for the city of Milton to come up with a fall festival. So that will be happening on the 30th. And I believe the main event is going to be downtown, you know, on the riverfront at Jernigan's Landing.
Okay.
I know we're supposed to do a better job this year of decorating more of our, you know, corridors and not just one small section of street on Willing Street. I think they're going to decorate all of Willing Street and Caroline Street, which will be great.
That's
because
beautiful.
We want people to, that's where the main traffic is, and they need to see they need to see the enthusiasm, you know, in downtown
Milton. I'll do another
video.
I'll do another my famous 45-minute walks with the Facebook Live. That was before. I was actually in the Imogene during a stage check. The band was doing a sound check for a performance that night. I just started a video, and 45 minutes later, I got done. Just started walking around going, hey, this is interesting. Let's see what's going on here. You know, it helps to be a kid.
Yeah.
I got a question on the waterfront, though, because and here's something that happens. It's absolutely amazing. And I was talking to one of the boat owners this weekend. So we had Bands on the Blackwater. We had this wonderful artist who was performing from 7 to 9. And of course, I'm listening to that. I'm walking around. I also want to mention K&B Cafe, et cetera. This is an incredible store that's a clothing store. It's got a motorcycle, you know, jacket and leather store. You've got a cafe upstairs. You've got vintage, you know, vinyl albums and all kinds of other things.
Yeah,
anyway, so they're
clothing.
Brightly lit. Say it again.
Men's clothing, the second
men's
full
clothing.
Men's
yeah.
clothing shop.
Yep. Yep. Yeah. Yeah, in fact, that's Sherry, and I've asked her for a long-sleeve cotton Hawaiian shirt that I can use for my band Starfish.
Right.
I want to have some bright color that I can
You'll
perform in.
You'll be able
in, so.
To find it.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah. But I want to mention them, too, because they're downtown and they're on the way, so if you're going to or from a concert. But the point was that I was getting to, I started walking down the dock. Now, we had this absolutely beautiful, the dock is lit up, the post that the boats tie up to is lit up, and you've got the Blackwater River right there, you've got this wonderful train bridge that's also lit up at night, and boats just come, and they'll dock for the night, they'll come here, you know, early in the evening, and they'll tie up and listen to the concert and have fun, and, you know, meet the next morning with their friends and go to breakfast and take off back home or go wherever they're going to go next. You know, it's a great start to a lot of people's weekends that Friday night. Are there any plans that you know of or anything you can tell me in terms of what might happen there to expand the dock beyond literally just a dock? I mean, it's just a place for people to tie up, and it's a beautiful walk. But what do you see happening
there?
Yeah,
we have had discussions about that, mm-hmm. but I'm not sure how soon some of that will take place. And you got to remember, it wasn't that long ago when Milton used to not let boats tie up and stay overnight. They literally
when was that?
Used to chase them. That was when Sharon Holly was the code enforcement officer.
What was her position? Enforcing
like,
what code?
It's like
you can't tie up. You can't boats can't tie up at the boat dock.
They hadn't
explain
I
that one.
I believe they had an ordinance. Yeah, I believe there was an ordinance that you could not be parked there longer than 12 hours. And you know
what?
That people would actually call and complain. Hey, this boat's down here. You know, overnight. Oh yeah. That's
so
long gone.
Oh, good.
I mean, I say, you know, it wasn't that long ago, but you know, you like to say it's long ago because Milton has really moved forward, you know, since
right.
then.
Yeah, from the dark
I'm
ages.
I'm still fighting to get benches actually on the boardwalk so people can sit on the boardwalk and enjoy, you know, the river. I mean, anyone else find that to be odd? We have this beautiful boardwalk and there's no place to sit.
Yeah.
You cannot actually sit on the boardwalk. That's crazy to me.
Oh, yeah, and you
Come
could light it up a
book,
little better. You
it,
could have old-time
yeah.
street lamps. You could have musicians, street musicians entertaining down there. Just put up a guitar and, you know, and a seat and
well,
a million throw a hat out front. I don't care. You know. Okay.
Yeah, when I was associated with the Riverwalk Arts Festival, uh-huh. I mean, yeah, we've had all of that. We've had poetry. You know, we've had everything like that going on. But there, uh-huh. So a few of the things that you asked me about regarding the dock that has been considered. So okay. The dock originally was not very boater friendly. And I don't know if they've installed any type of, you know, bumpers down there or any protections. Because, you know, that river, you know, it's low 1 minute and high the next. So
yeah,
there's
active.
No real area set aside to accommodate people getting, you know, in and out of your boat when, you know, if the river's lower. I mean, mm-hmm. you have to practically, you know, crawl. It's like flop
we
out
need
on
a floating
the boardwalk,
dock.
You know.
In some kind of a floating
yeah,
dock
so
or something
yeah,
that's
so you
like
need
a gangway
something
access.
Lower.
Yeah.
Yeah, they don't allow any fishing or anything like that, so that was the other thing that was being looked at was a specific area that would provide for fishing and
mm-hmm.
also an area for kayak and canoe launching because
mm-hmm.
we don't have that either. Now, you can go over to, like, Baghdad, Baghdad Mill Site Park, but those were some of the ideas, and we do have the developer that's looking at the, you know, pretty large riverfront development
mm-hmm.
Just north of, you know, Will of Caroline Street. And I know that they are still active with conversations with the city. And that was also going to provide for an extension of the boardwalk going north all the way to Carpenter's Park. So that would be huge.
Oh, yeah. You could do, you know, what else would be nice to have is like a fuel pump so the boats can actually fuel up.
Well,
so
actually,
they
were supposed to put that in at the marina. And
okay.
I don't know if that exists, you know, right now or not. But that was originally the plan. And I know they redid all the boat slips
mm-hmm.
up there and they were supposed to put in the gas pumps.
Yeah. that we need some restaurants right along that waterfront street that's just behind the actual boardwalk itself. I still want an Italian restaurant, okay, with like those Chianti bottles, you know, with the candles and with the wax kind of dripping down.
Yes.
Okay, so we need that back again. Okay,
we
so it looks like we've had
one
everything
years
we need.
Ago.
Yeah. Okay.
I have a building that's available for that. We have full architectural drawings for full service restaurant and bar overlooking the river.
Okay. Well, do you want to give any information out so people can get in touch with you? Feel free or not. It's up to you. Or you can think about it.
Yeah.
We'll talk.
I'll put that out when it's actively, you know, listed through the MLS.
Yeah. Also, Facebook pages of any of the groups that you're talking about, like the Butterfly House or the Railroad Museum, you know, so people can find that. And again, for the folks around the country, this is a model for you to develop. I mean, if you have an old railroad track, you can make a train museum. It doesn't take a lot. Cassandra, I'm sorry, go ahead.
The train depot is, you can find it under the West Florida Railroad Museum Facebook page. And any information about, and the Historical Society, we share, you know, their posts also. But for the Ghost Walk, you can find us either under the Santa Rosa Historical Society or the Imogene Theater. The Butterfly House is friends of the Panhandle Butterfly House and Nature Center? Yeah, and Nature Center. But you have to put friends of in front of it. They had a little issue where a former member literally stole their Facebook page.
They
go to friends of. They literally stole it. Friends of Panhandle Butterfly House and Nature Center. And then, of course, Milton Garden Club, I think that is the actual name of their Facebook page, is Milton Garden Club.
Yeah.
And they've named that building now Magnolia Hall.
Oh, nice.
It might be Milton Garden Club of Northwest Florida. I think that's it.
Okay. I just find it fascinating.
And then
the butterflies
City of
are controversial.
Do what?
I find it fascinating the butterflies are controversial, that they have a Facebook page war.
Well,
it just cracks me up.
It is. Some people become a little obsessive and want to take ownership of something that's a nonprofit meant for the community. So
yeah,
you know,
never seen that before.
Sometimes,
you know, people, people are relating to
this. Egos get involved.
Oh yeah, you know, I can see people relating to this. You know, in Kansas and California and, you know, Maine and, you know, Washington, going, yeah,
yeah,
we got that in our town too. Because you know
this
is happening.
Little town. Yeah.
Everybody has their little town characters. Well, it'd be interesting to see if our little town characters match up with other little towns' characters. So if you're in another little town and you
Trust
have characters
me,
like we have characters, you know, call in. We'll do a little character exchange. This would be
fun.
Well, you know, because characters make up the
life.
Characters make up your life. That's
it'd
what makes
be
it fun.
A day of. Sorry, there's a little bit of a delay. I was just going to say, it'd be a day of, I've got a story for you. This is what happens in my little town.
Well, that's why I love doing this conversation with you, because I hope you can, you know, come on regularly and we can talk about some of the things that are going on here. I want to leave with one story before I let you go. If you have about two more minutes, the Imogene, you know, is haunted. Now, let me say this for the folks that are you know, all over the place here, and the reason that a classic theater is such a huge addition to your town, and it's going to be massive for Milton once we start getting national acts again. Again, I saw B.J. Thomas there, Leanne Womack was there. I've seen the Milton High School Jazz Band there, so it's a great local venue.
Amazing.
For performers. I want to play there with my band Starfish. You know, we got to talk. Anyway, but I was there watching, I think it was either the Milton High School or Leanne Womack. I'm not sure who it was, or maybe a different performance, but I'm up there in the balcony and I'm just kind of sitting down and like there's nobody beside me on either side. I'm just kind of hanging up there. And all of a sudden I felt this presence beside me. Okay. I knew somebody, you know, when someone's there and you look around, there's like somebody, you know, 5 feet away from me. Hey, how you doing? You know, trying to get your attention kind of thing. Or it's just, you know, it's like for some reason we human beings are have a subconscious, you know, we know when someone's looking at us, whether it's the gym or the elevator or the office or wherever you're walking down the street, you know, when someone is looking at you, you look right at them and they try and look away. So, you know, somebody's there, right? Well, I had that exact same feeling in the Imogene. I knew somebody who was there. Of course, when I looked, there's nothing there, okay, but I knew there was a presence there. I mean, I felt an actual physical presence of a human being that was there right beside me in the Imogene, but nobody was there. I knew when they showed up, and I knew when they left.
Yeah, we've had the ghost chasers, you know, in there over the years.
Oh, I've done it.
And they've documented some different, you know, orbs and this and that. I can tell you that personally, I've never had that experience in the Imogene. And, you know, I also own the historic post office building, and people have sworn that that's haunted. And I think that was civil service, and that's where the guys had to go and, you know, sign up for the draft. So I think they have nightmares. I know they do, you know, about that when they used to come in and be able to go downstairs. And also in the post office, I've never had that experience. I was told, well, you have to invite them. You have to be open. You have to invite yourself, you know, invite them, you know, to you and whatever. So I've done that too, but haven't had that experience in either one of the buildings. But
you will.
You know, rumor has it.
But you do have to be open to it.
I'm in there enough. I should.
Yeah. So the old post office is now Brew Angels, which is a fabulous craft brewery with great food and trivia night and some other wonderful things like that. And then my new favorites across the street, Beardless Brew House has moved. I always love that name because the only craft brewers that don't have beards, that's how they got their name. And it's now Gulf Coast Garage, which are friends of mine. And we did our first gig there. We got rained out, unfortunately. We only got to play two sets. So we're going to go back. We're going to switch out some songs. The new improved Starfish, we'll be back in about a month or so. We're going to go woodshed for a while. We're going to rehearse a little bit and get better. But it was a fabulous opportunity to play there and met some friends and great support. And so we'll be doing that again. But, this is the town. You know, I mean, I love this town. And just on a personal note, to be able to come to a place and work when I started at WBY in a place that I'd never seen, you know, hired by a boss that never met me, you know, in a job I've never held, you know, full-time radio host, to be able to do that here. You know, it's amazing things I'm not qualified for that I do, write legislation,
you know,
create action radio, you know, a brand new broadcasting genre. I don't have a broadcast degree. I don't have a communications degree. I don't have a law degree. I'm writing legislation like crazy. So this is the beautiful thing about this area and the people here is just the opportunity. Yes, it's like Cheers. Yes, it's like a small town, and yes, we have our characters. But the ability to do something here. There's a lot of places that would not have welcomed me like this town did, you know. And I'm still hoping for more support. I mean, there's still some things I'd love to see. But in terms of being able to do what I do here and not be run out of town like I might have been in the San Francisco Bay Area when people thought you could do what. You're going to write legislation? You fascist. You're a Trump Nazi. I mean, the list could be endless. But I wouldn't be able to do there what I'm able to do here. And so that's why I stayed after, I lost my job at WBY because I knew this was the area. I knew this is the place. And I knew this town is going to be, you know, going to do some amazing things. And this is the place where I really wanted to have Action Radio centered. And so when we create our World Center for Citizen Legislation and we start holding worldwide conventions of people from all over who are learning how to write their own laws, how just regular people are learning how to, you know, reverse the trend of the government dictating the laws to you, and you're basically saying, well, these are the laws we consent to. We're not forcing them, but we're using the parliamentary or the constitutional systems, and this is what we consent to. We are the source of legislation, not the special interests, not the large corporations, not the wacko groups, not the George Soros, not those people. We the people are. We're actually going to bring we the people and have we the people mean something. This is the place I want to do it. And it's because of the environment, and it's because of the people, and it's because of the things that are going on here, and the advancement, and I see the new stores, and the new restaurants, and the waterfront, and the courthouse, the courthouse market, and all these incredible things happening. It's the people that make whatever's going to happen with Action Radio, it's the people here that are going to help make that possible, and that's why I'm here, and it's kind of a special place to me. So there's my,
as Jeff Snow would say, it's a great time to be in Milton. Mm-hmm. And you were speaking of careers, and while I, you know, was out there for a little over 5 hours directing traffic and all of that, I did have someone come up to me and tell me that, you know, I have found my new career. And I also had a couple who was driving
traffic
by
director?
Who had been to the museum. They came by and stopped and tipped me $20, which of course turned into a donation for the Railroad Museum.
Well, you need a whistle.
So, anyway.
You need a whistle and white gloves. If you're going to be a traffic director, you got to have a whistle and white gloves.
Right.
Yeah. All right, Cassandra, thank you so much. This has been a lot more than I
expected.
And
we're hoping
for
sidewalks.
Sidewalks,
okay.
That'd be nice too.
Have a great day.
You too. Thank you very much.
Okay. Bye-bye.
All right. Cassandra Sharp with our local report here, head of the Historical Society, and just all around interesting person. All right. I'm going to play, before it gets too late, and we have Dr. Pratt coming at the top of the hour, our Santa Rosa Volunteers piece, this time on Federalist Papers number 6, and then we'll take the remaining time before Dr. Pratt gets here, and we'll talk about the many scandals du jour, and I'll be back in a bit. This is Greg Penglis for Action Radio with Founding Moments. Insights into our founding documents, sponsored by Santa Rosa Volunteers, here in Santa Rosa County, Florida. Santa Rosa Volunteers is available at their website, srv1776.com. That's srv1776.com. We now leave the tepid and vapid John Jay for someone far better known, yet equally contemptible, for lying to the American people, for bringing up the boogeyman of what might happen as a reason to move from the Articles of Confederation during a time when the states were probably their most united after our war for independence against Great Britain, where there is no such evidence of an actual split of the Confederation of States into the 3 to 4 independent confederacies so described over and over by the Federalists. In other words, it's the same old story. Scare the people away from something good to something worse when that worse benefits you. Ironically, it is under the Constitution that the states broke into the Confederacy in the mid-1800s that led to the Civil War. There is no way to know if such would have happened under the Articles of Confederation. I've searched the internet and cannot find any instance where any one or more groups of states formed their own confederations against the other states or against the new federal government under the Articles of Confederation. Alexander Hamilton, who wrote Federalist No. 6, is far more intellectual and therefore far more persuasive than John Jay. Hamilton unfortunately still uses the same framework of arguing against something that doesn't exist while trying to sell a solution because it might happen, maybe, with that solution being an entirely new constitution where no one knows if or how it would work. Ironically, the Constitution actually ends up allowing for the same abuses of power that it allegedly was created to prevent, and that it causes over time the very problems Hamilton said would not happen if they repealed the Articles of Confederation. In a prescient paragraph, Hamilton, while trying to sell what will not happen, outlines exactly what has happened over time under the Constitution. He begins, "The causes of hostility among nations are innumerable. There are some which have a general and almost constant operation upon the collective bodies of society. Of this description are the love of power or the desire of preeminence and dominion, the jealousy of power, or the desire of equality and safety. There are others which have a more circumscribed, though an equally operative influence within their spheres. Such are the rivalships and competitions of commerce between commercial nations, and there are others, not less numerous than either of the former, which take their origin entirely in private passions, in the attachments, enmities, interests, hopes, and fears of leading individuals in the communities of which they are members. Men of this class, whether the favorites of a king or of a people, have in too many instances abused the confidence they possessed, and assuming the pretext of some public motive, have not scrupled to sacrifice the national tranquility to personal advantage or personal gratification." Much of this should ring true. Dr. Anthony Fauci, whom we affectionately call Dr. Fascist here at Action Radio, is the preeminent example of this personal, pathological power and wealth decadency and obsession. Alexander Hamilton then goes through a bunch of examples of corruption, greed, and despotism in countries that were monarchies or otherwise centrally controlled as relevant and comparable to our unique Confederation of States, which were probably the most decentralized of any nation. They weren't relevant comparisons, but he tried to make that argument anyway, and made it the basis of his, we better ratify the Constitution or that scenario will happen argument. But without any prediction of the actual breakdown into those 3 to 4 factions and what those factions might be, it's speculation at best, propaganda at worst. Hamilton also says, so far is the general sense of mankind from corresponding with the tenets of those who endeavor to lull asleep our apprehensions of discord and hostility between the states in the event of disunion, that it has from long observation of the progress of society become a sort of axiom in politics, that vicinity or nearness of situation constitutes nations' natural enemies. An intelligent writer expresses himself on this subject to this effect. Okay, paragraph break here. He is saying that because the states are next to each other, conflict is only a matter of time. And then he tries to tie his false premise, invalid comparisons, and made-up conclusions all together with an exasperated expression of the futility of human nature. And so it's all going to fall apart anyway. Unless you follow him and the Federalists into the Constitution. He says, finishing the paragraph, neighboring nations are naturally enemies of each other unless their common weakness forces them to league into a confederate republic, and their constitution prevents the differences that neighborhood occasions, extinguishing that secret jealousy which disposes all states to aggrandize themselves at the expense of their neighbors. This passage, at the same time, points out the evil and suggests the remedy. Okay, so how does this suggest the remedy exactly? Call me crazy, but it appears the Federalists are arguing for the Constitution without actually using the Constitution in their arguments. No provisions of the Constitution have been gone over. No provisions have been highlighted as examples of how to prevent the very descending into chaos they so fervently argue will happen without the Constitution. I'm guessing the people of this time were as confused as I am today. The source for the Federalist Papers is federalistpapers.org. The Anti-Federalist Papers are from foundingfathersquotes.com. The Articles of Confederation are from usconstitution.net. This is Greg Penglis for Action Radio with Founding Moments, sponsored by Santa Rosa Volunteers. Their website is srv1776.com. That's srv1776.com. Please share this report to anyone who needs it. This is Greg Penglis for Action Radio with a personal recommendation and testimonial for Eric Colley, our new webmaster and marketing guru. Eric has been invaluable in upgrading our website, writeyourlaws.com. To help you with your marketing, Eric Colley offers proven, cost-effective strategies to help small businesses, startups, and nonprofits market themselves on Google Page One. You can gain thousands of followers and be far more competitive, and this is the good part, without paid advertising. Most business owners don't have the time or expertise to excel at marketing. Even fewer have the funds to hire a special employee. And you don't have to. There is a better option. Eric Colley, a consultant who uses leading-edge marketing strategies to increase your profitability at costs which are far more affordable than an advertising or marketing agency. You can be seen high up in Google's Page One. You can dominate Google's local three-pack of businesses next to the search results map. You can be trusted as much as personal recommendations from family and friends. You can increase foot and website traffic. You can do all this, all without paying Google, Facebook, or Instagram one red cent. Eric Colley can be reached at 208-999-7510. That's 208-999-7510. His website is besmallbusiness.com. That's besmallbusiness.com. BESMALLBUSINESS. besmallbusiness.com. And you can reach him by email at eric@besmallbusiness.com. And that's how you do it.
Action Radio. Dangerously cool.
All right, we're back. It's this is fun. Actually, we got a really good report from Cassandra, more than I expected, which is great. So there's so many things happening here. And again, the reason I like to do this is because there's so many things you can do with your town if you have a historic district, and especially if you have the opposition that we have, where people want to put a four-lane freeway directly through our historic district. I mean, you might as well just pave over the whole thing if you're going to do that. I mean, this is just a crime, and we're going to stop that crime. We're not going to let that happen. And so that's what's going on here. Gene, and Jackie, if you want to call back, and anybody else wants to join us, we got about 10 minutes before Dr. Pry joins us. So anything of you on your mind of late with all the different things happening, feel free. Feel free to beep in and get a hold of us here. Gene, any thoughts of anything on your mind right now?
No, nothing in particular.
Okay.
Oh,
yeah, we covered a lot.
There's one. Gosh, I was Stuart, the guy, the military person. I haven't heard within the last day or two, but he was supposed to have been let out of prison last week. So that's a good thing.
Oh yeah, the lieutenant colonel who was the whistleblower.
Yes.
For what's
yes.
really going on there? Yeah. That would be nice. That'd be nice to have him out. Yeah,
and it was interesting because he sent a text, or not a text, maybe email, something, and he blasted Trump, too. He's just making a lot of waves, but I'm glad he's out. That's a good thing because I think there's better ways to get to the bottom of things.
Yeah. Did you see the Trump rally at all?
I started to watch it a little bit, and then I stopped. But there was another article I read that there was a Indiana family, parents and two kids that went in to get the flu shot and got the vax. I thought that, you know, those stories continue.
Oh, they're not telling people? Are they combining them or are they just not telling people they're giving a COVID?
No, they made another mistake.
Oh, they did. So in other words, they picked up a vial that said COVID. And neither the person giving it nor the person receiving it actually read the label as to what they were getting. Is that what happened?
Apparently. I don't. I just think it's sad. It's just very sad. But.
Well, now, here's the problem, though. I mean, you know, we have libel laws, we have criminal laws, we have malpractice laws and things like that, but it doesn't matter. But once that garbage is in your system, you're irrevocably changed. You have messenger RNA. With body immunity protection. In other words, it's protected from your body's immunity to do whatever it does. And nobody knows. I mean, Dr. Mikovits, who created vaccines, doesn't even know what's in it.
Right.
You know, and so it's too late. You can't go back from it. There's no restitution. There's no recovery. It's not like stolen property where you get your property back. Okay. This is it. You know, once you get the COVID infusion. You know, there's no way to get back from that. So they're giving this thing. Now, it's one thing if people take it willingly, but obviously they don't believe in that. They want there's either such a profit motive or such an ideological motive or such a fear motive or maybe, you know, various, you know, permutations, combinations of that, that this is what's going on. But this is crazy to me that this can be allowed. I mean, I don't know what the crime, you need some horrendous punishment for anybody that does it. Like I said, you can't make up for it, but you can lock them up in jail for 25 years. You have to prove intent. I mean, it's going to get messy no matter how you do it. The biggest thing is for people, if you're dumb enough to get the vaccine, at least be smart enough to read the damn label. Let me put it that way. Let's get back to Pianki.
Right.
He's back here. Yeah. Pianki?
Yeah, you know what I was going to hope that you would elaborate on was the Texas school shooting.
Oh, I can elaborate. I'd be happy to elaborate.
And
I just happen to have an article on that. Black privilege. Let's talk about this. So I found this article. It's kind of cool, actually. It's by Off Grid Survival. it's a skull mask and a cowboy hat. Anyway, so this is October 7th, 2021, Off Grid Survival. I guess that's the author. Face of Privilege, Arlington, Texas school shooter released on bail. Yeah, this is a tragedy. This is a horrible crime. It's a horrible crime, first of all, but the second horrible crime is the fact that because it's a black kid, the media won't cover it, and he gets released the same day and then goes to a party or whatever he does. He's out on bail, whereas a white kid, you know, would be worldwide news, locked up forever, and they'd be calling for the death penalty. Anyway, it says the black 18-year-old school shooter who opened fire in an Arlington, Texas school on Wednesday, injuring four people, two of whom are in critical condition, was released on $75,000 bail today. That is insane. Timothy George Simpkins. Let's name him. For all those that didn't know his name, it's like Michael J. Byrd, you know, the Capitol Hill police lieutenant who assassinated Ashley Babbitt. I don't mind naming names. Eric Chiaramella, the whistleblower that nobody wants to name. Yeah, I don't mind naming names when they deserve to be named. Timothy George Simpkins, 18, has been charged with three counts of aggravated assault. Why not attempted murder? Aggravated assault? Why, he was mad when he assaulted people? For firing a .45 caliber gun during a fist fight at a school on Wednesday morning before fleeing in his Dodge Charger. So not only did he commit the crime, he fled the scene. Arlington Assistant Police Chief Kevin Colby, you know, said during a news conference Wednesday afternoon that the shooting stemmed from a fight that broke out in the classroom. Okay, so they got the video, they got all kinds of stuff. You know, and then we got, what else we got here? Let's see. He says, oddly, as soon as the media figured out the shooter was black, the story seemed to die quicker than a coronavirus patient on a ventilator. This person has a way with words. This is the first time I've got an article from this story. I kind of like it, though. He says, of course, as usual, the family claims he was a good boy and was only acting out because he was being bullied over being financially, quote, blessed, having fancy clothes and a $35,000 car. Now, I don't know about you, but when I went to high school, I was not financially blessed. I didn't have fancy clothes. I didn't have any car. I walked. You know, it says he was able to get these things that other teenagers cannot have because he wore nice clothes, because he drove nice cars. He was like a target. Okay, well, there's black privilege. You know, well, look at him. I mean, you know, it's just this just reeks of racism all the way through it. Last little bit here says, on top of being released, he is not even being charged with attempted murder. Yeah, I made that point earlier, too. Instead, Simpkins is facing three counts of aggravated assault with a deadly weapon. The sister of the teacher who was wounded was disgusted by the release, tweeted a video of him walking out of the jail and said, how does this keep managing to get worse? Yeah, there's more to the article, but that's basically it. Pianki?
Gene, what did I call in for?
You guys talking again off? Were you like screaming again? You guys having a private conversation? I mean, I don't mind.
You know, you left one thing out.
What did I leave out?
It kind of reminds me of Kyle Rittenhouse. But Kyle Rittenhouse got castigated and demonized and persecuted. Everything except nailed on the cross, which may yet to come. And
that was self.
Kyle Rittenhouse.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was a hero. He was being attacked. He was, he was, people tried to harm him seriously. The one that was skateboard, and they wasn't trying to hit him with the flat part of the skateboard. They were trying to hit him with the corner, the edge that could crack his skull.
Yeah.
Then another perpetrator, that a thug that tried to harm him, had a pistol. But look how he was raked through the media cold. The police gave him a bottle of water. This guy here gets a party. They like to make a reference of the shooter in the church. What was his name? I can't think of his name right now.
I'm not sure either.
That Root, Dalen Root. They said the police took him to Burger King, which I understand is sort of like policy, department policy or something of that nature.
Well, they feed you when you're arrested?
But this guy here gets a party. A big celebration for coming home for pennies on the dollar bail.
Well, let me ask you a question.
That is what you call black privilege.
Oh, it's definitely black privilege. But here's what's interesting, too. He's got a $35,000 car. Most Americans don't have that. Most Americans, what's the average car, $20,000, $25,000? When people are buying a new car, and a lot of Americans buy recently used or even really used. You know, so the idea this guy has $35,000 car.
He's got a diamond earring, gold.
He's got nice clothes.
Gold teeth.
So... Now, is this rich privilege, or is this black privilege, or is this black rich privilege?
It's probably all of it.
Yeah.
That will never be commented on. And it's not the only one. A lot of this goes on.
Yeah.
A lot of you had a case in St. Louis where 11-year-old pistol whips a carjack victim as his mother watched him and his mother gets a driver to give them a lift, and in the process of giving them a lift, The 11-year-old in the back pulls out a pistol and smacks him upside the head. The mother takes the keys.
Yep.
I mean, it's stuff like that that the news don't cover. And when they don't cover and they don't mention the race, then we know what's going on.
Well, and the problem with this is it's going to breed a culture of black immunity. You know, it's one thing, you know, for the hundreds of years where, you know, black people were more likely to be persecuted and the sentences were higher. You know, there's a lot of documentation on that. There's a lot of documentation that men receive higher sentences for the same crime than women and get higher conviction rates. That's documented. So, but the problem is if you try and this is like criminal affirmative action. So in other words, because they're black, they get special privilege and they get a quota of freedom compared to a white assailant in the same position. And so this is going to encourage a whole lot more crime and breed sort of an atmosphere of black immunity. And what is this saying, you know, to black Americans that black kids, you know, I would think it would make a lot of folks fearful because if 11-year-old carjackers are okay, you know, most of the crime committed by black Americans is on other black Americans. This is not a good thing no matter how you look at it. But this judicial privilege that's going on is going to be a big problem. And the liberals think it's such a wonderful thing. Well, the people of color, we have to, you know, they're different. They're not as good as the rest of everybody. They don't know the laws. They can't, you know, we have to, you know, make special allowances for them because, you know, it's racism. It's really a form of racism.
You're absolutely right. It is racism. It's,
yes, it's white liberals, but it's did I say black supremacists. So what do you do then?
Did I say 11-year-old? Well,
yeah,
previous
did.
Before that, over in the Soulard area, it was a 12-year-old black kid that pistol whip. No, he didn't pistol whip, but he carjacks a driver.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing is heard of. It dies very fast, like the article read, as if it had the COVID virus.
Well, this is fascinating. So I'm curious to see whether, you know, where this case goes. But follow up on it. If you want to bring it back up on the show anytime, I mean, I have no problem with that. But we have a black
supremacy
problem.
It'll be like it
problem.
Is in Chicago. Mm-hmm. You know, I had a recent incident where five criminals was involved in a shooting in Chicago. And the prosecutor, Kim Fox, who's friends with the squad, they come down to St. Louis to stand alongside another inefficient prosecutor, Kim Gardner, and something about black female Kims that's prosecutor, and she refuses to prosecute any one of those five. She gets in a big argument with Lori Lightfoot, the mayor of Chicago.
Is
they're a member of a faction.
Yeah.
Being a member of a faction keep you from being prosecuted? I didn't know that. Did you?
I didn't either, but this whole idea of racial immunity we might have to explore. I've got Dr. Pry on the line, so I want to get to our national security report. And I have no idea what he's going to talk about. This is kind of cool. Usually we sort of at least get topics ahead of time. I got a few of my own, but let's hold up. We need to
give my greetings to Dr. Pry, please.
Oh, you can stick around if you want, but I want to explore further. You know, the black immunity, black privilege, black supremacy, in terms of how detrimental it is to this country and black people. You know, this is not a good thing no matter how you look at it. So we need to talk about that more. All right, I'll be right back. What is national security? How much is enough? What about the cost? What are our adversaries doing? Who wins between the State Department and the Pentagon? How accurate is our intelligence capability? Are we keeping up with our nuclear deterrent? Do we have better weapons than our adversaries? How would we know? Can we withstand an EMP attack? How is our missile defense? How about the basic power grid? Is it safe? These are the questions Dr. Pry has been dealing with his whole career. Dr. Peter Vincent Pry is the Executive Director of the Task Force on National and Homeland Security. He has served on the Congressional EMP Commission, the Congressional Strategic Posture Commission, the House Armed Services Committee, and the CIA. He is the author of The Power and the Light, the Congressional EMP Commission's War to Save America. And now he anchors the National Security Report here on Action Radio. How much national security is enough? And now, Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. Well, sir, it would be hard to top your last week's appearance because you were on such a roll. It was inspiring. But how are you doing this week, and where would you like to go?
Well, I hope that that the reception is okay. I hope you can hear me okay. Call you from a location where the connectivity on my end, at least, doesn't sound so great. How is it coming across?
Well, it's a little quieter, but that's okay. People can turn up their volume. So I don't know if you bring the phone closer or whatever you're able to do. But, yeah, I can hear you just fine.
Okay, so great. Yeah, mm-hmm. I'd like to talk about, since we are, you know, I'd like to talk about the article that I sent you over the weekend. About the growing crisis over Taiwan, which could turn into a nuclear crisis, over fears of China's possibly imminent invasion and attempt to reconquer Taiwan, and comparing that, drawing parallels to that with the Cuban Missile Crisis. We're coming up on the 59th anniversary of the Cuban Missile Crisis, which the National Archives dates as beginning from on October 16th. The official period is from October 16th to November 20th, when the Cuban Missile Crisis happened. And I still remember that, even though I was in elementary school. I remember, not only do I remember that, but I remember, you know, even though I was only like 3 years old at the time, I remember.
Oh, difficult memory. Yeah.
I remember being at my grandmother's house, you know, standing out in her front yard with all my cousins, because we knew Sputnik was passing by overhead, and you could actually see it. And it wasn't a friendly thing. I mean, this was an act of technological supremacy by the Soviet Union, and
right.
A lot of people don't remember that in 1962, when the Cuban Missile Crisis happened, we were really worried that America was technologically behind, that we might be at a military disadvantage vis-a-vis the Soviet Union. At least that was the concern. And Sputnik had been, you know, which occurred, you know, 5 years before the Cuban Missile Crisis. Nonetheless, mm-hmm. It was seared into people's minds, and also seared into our minds was the fact that, you know, we were way behind in the space race, and people had seen on their televisions failure after failure of our efforts to launch a satellite of our own into space. Kennedy was elected on the idea that there was a missile gap, an ICBM gap between the United States and the Soviet Union. And when he came into office, one of the things he did, you know, was to do a crash program to build up our ICBM force. It's a good thing he did, because when the Cuban Missile Crisis occurred in 1962, the reason we won, and the Democrat Party, you know, never talks about this part. You know, they always act as if it was only because of Kennedy's leadership and courage that we prevailed mm-hmm. in the Cuban Missile Crisis. But the real reason we prevailed in the Missile Crisis is that Kennedy was prudent enough to have built up our ICBM force so that we had a 5-to-1 superiority over the Soviets in ICBMs at the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis. And we also had a vast superiority in our strategic bomber force. And that they never talk about. You know, that is what made the difference between resolving the Cuban Missile Crisis peacefully mm-hmm. and a thermonuclear World War III. Because the Soviets probably wouldn't have backed off if the situation was reversed and they had superiority.
Do you think those are the only options, though? In other words, nuclear war or just, I'm wondering if there was some kind of other potential. I mean, I don't know. I'm just asking the question, but it just seems like there's always more choices than we're presented with when we get to, whenever we read history. I mean, I could be wrong.
Well, to libertarian types, there's always a third way.
Okay.
But in history and among superpowers, you know, especially since you had a generation that had just come out of World War II, okay,
right.
I'm sure that if we had the political science department of Harvard thinking about different ways of resolving World War II, you know, mm-hmm. they could come up with some ideas, all right?
Yeah. Okay.
But that things work in reality, in real life, Greg. Historically, when you've got two superpowers standing toe-to-toe, and in fact, we were fortunate that even with that outcome, even with mm-hmm. our superiority in intercontinental missiles, that it didn't turn into a thermonuclear war, because you have to remember that the confrontation was not just over the missiles. I mean, of course, that was the most important thing, especially from the point of view of the United States and the Soviet Union. But there was an ideological contest going on in the early Cold War, an ideological contest. Now most reasonable people, although that's not true anymore, but today most reasonable people think, well, communism doesn't work, socialism doesn't work, you know. But in the 60s, the free world was having was really divided ideologically over, you know, whether the free political and free economic systems could stand up and could compete with the Soviet Union. And one of the things that gave us great angst over this was the technological gap, you know, where Soviet communism had taken Russia, which was pretty much a technologically backward country, and in a few decades, despite that, not only did they win World War II, basically, you know, and despite the tremendous damage that was suffered by their country in World War II, they had engaged in reconstructing their country, and now we're beating the United States in high-tech weapons of the future. And, you know, Cuba was more than just a little island in the Caribbean. You know, Cuba was in the backyard of the free world's leading leader of free economic and political systems. And we were heavily invested in Cuba, yet Cuba had decided to throw off the quote-unquote shackles of capitalism and go communist. So that was an enormous ideological victory for the unfree world, for the Soviet bloc. It was such an important development from our point of view, you know, because having them go communist, linkages to the Soviet Union, you know, challenged our centuries-long commitment to the idea of keeping Europe out of our hemisphere under the Monroe Doctrine, and that you know, the Americas should be, you know, left alone to these ties from Europe. And that was important enough that Kennedy went ahead with the Bay of Pigs, you know, which failed, you know, because the ideological contest was given such importance by the Department of State and by the president, you know, that we did not want to appear like an imperial power by using our full military strength. I mean, we could have taken Cuba if we sent in the Navy and the Marines and did a World War II type operation, but the ideological contest was so important to us that we wanted it to appear that the Cubans themselves had thrown off the yoke of communism. So we organized an exile Cuban army to go in there, but it was inadequately supported and ended up being a disaster.
It's kind of like Afghanistan, right? It's kind of like we're training the Afghanistan army to defend their own country, and it didn't work out at all. You know, there's a parallel there, yeah.
It is. There is a parallel there. Moving forward on this, so the Soviets were concerned about the United States wanting to take over Cuba and crush communism. It was a enormous propaganda victory for them, because don't forget the eyes of the third world. We were engaged in a struggle for the future of the planet. Which way is the third world going to go? You know, are they going to follow the communist model? Or are they going to follow the free enterprise, you know, free world model? And so they wanted to make sure that Cuba, you know, continued as a standing rebuke to capitalism in the backyard of the chief capitalist power. They militarily, it was right at the edge of their ability to project power. You know, they couldn't get enough naval forces or air forces in that air part of the world to defend Cuba from an American takeover in the future. So they tried to defend Cuba by extended nuclear deterrence, you know, the threat of their ICBM force. But then the decision to put in medium-range and intermediate-range ballistic missiles, and as it later turned out, we didn't know it at the time, but tactical nuclear missiles as well. And this would not only guarantee, and the Soviets thought it would guarantee, the continued sovereignty and communist existence of Cuba, Even more importantly, it would enable them to have a surprise first strike capability against the United States, Cuba being only 90 miles away from the United States. It would get in under our early warning capabilities so that we wouldn't be able to respond to a surprise nuclear attack. And it would compensate for the disadvantage that they had in intercontinental ballistic missiles. And I just want to, as a footnote, how is it that the Soviets ended up with a disadvantage in intercontinental ballistic missiles when they were technologically ahead of us, all right? Well, the Soviets thought that World War III, if it happened, was going to be fought for possession of Europe. So they focused their nuclear ballistic missile program on intermediate range and medium range ballistic missiles for targeting Europe. And when it came to the European balance of nuclear power, they had a 5-to-1 advantage over us there, or even more. And so they had been putting their economic energies and scientific energies into focusing on that part of the nuclear balance, because nobody thought, including the United States, that if World War III came between the United States and the Soviet Union, that it was going to happen anywhere except in Europe. After all, they had a series of crises that came close to a nuclear war already, with the Berlin crisis, for example, prior to the Cuban Missile Crisis. And so both sides were surprised when we found ourselves on the brink of a nuclear war over this little island in the Caribbean, where the intercontinental balance of nuclear power mattered most. And it was after the Cuban Missile Crisis that the Soviets really started going gangbusters with ICBMs so that they would close the missile gap on their side and gain and strive to gain superiority. But the main point from our lessons today, or one of the chief lessons learned, as we approach the anniversary of the Cuban Missile Crisis, is that John F. Kennedy, one of the heroes of the Democrat Party, and the Cuban Missile Crisis, which is, one of the badge of honor of the Democrat Party, they often point to that as, evidence of their being patriotic and having a great victory, was chiefly achieved because of Kennedy's decision build up our nuclear forces, because not only have a parity, not only have a nuclear deterrent that was second to none, which is what most conservatives are willing to settle for today, but to actually have superiority in the nuclear balance, a 5-to-1 superiority in ICBMs. And the numbers do matter. The Cuban Missile Crisis proved it. And that's why we ended up, it's really kind of a miracle when you think about it, that superiority enabled us to avoid a thermonuclear world war. Because the stakes were very high. Imagine how difficult it was for a totalitarian Soviet Union to engage in public humiliation, to be humiliated in front of the whole world and have to remove those missiles from Cuba in that relatively short period of time. This didn't go on for years. It just went on for a few weeks. But that strategic superiority, that overwhelming strategic superiority that the United States possessed, was enough to get them to reverse and to pull the missiles out of Cuba. That's of how powerful nuclear weapons can be, not even chiefly for war fighting, but for nuclear diplomacy, so that you can achieve victory without war. And it was done today. We had another
object
in this. We've talked about it before on the show about how Ronald Reagan won the Cold War without it becoming a thermonuclear war. Now, he didn't have superiority, but he didn't allow the Soviets to get superiority. He maintained parity so that they imploded economically, because communism basically doesn't work as an economic system. And especially Reagan's proposal of the so-called much derided Star Wars program, Strategic Defense Initiative, was the straw that broke their back, that they couldn't compete with us technologically in that. And so, Gorbachev reached out to try to to sign on to the START treaties, which is the first time when we started building down the nuclear forces, but then the Soviet Union collapsed. So lesson number one from the Cuban Missile Crisis is do not allow yourself to become inferior. Don't allow yourself to be in the position that the Soviet Union was in 1962. And unfortunately, in the case of Taiwan, we are allowing ourselves, I mean, history is sort of reversing itself. But I'm gonna shut up for a moment before I move on to drawing the parallels here with Taiwan. And by the way, I'm going to pat myself on the back. I'm really astonished that none of my colleagues, that nobody has even thought about, apparently, doing an analysis that compares the situation with the Cuban Missile Crisis, okay, with the mm-hmm. situation with Taiwan. You know, because there's immense parallels here. You know, I mean, Cuba, you know, was a small island which in the backyard of a military superpower that needed a superpower friend in order to maintain its independence. And in 1962, mm-hmm. that was the Soviet Union. And the situation is exactly analogous today with Taiwan, where, you know, Taiwan is a free political and economic system that's in the backyard of the communist China giant, and they need a superpower friend to maintain their independence, and it is us. And now we are fast approaching a confrontation with China over the independence of Taiwan. And my prediction is that the same factors that resolved the Cuban Missile Crisis, the balance of strategic nuclear power, will be crucial if the war comes. It might even be resolved without war. But I'm going to let you get in a word edgewise here, Greg, because I know you don't like me to just pontificate and go on.
Well, no, there's so many things that I like to ask, and if I wait till the end, then people have forgotten the point that you made that I want to ask a question about. So let me just go back over a couple of things. Taiwan's going to be fascinating. The difference I see immediate with Taiwan is that Russia had no designs on making Cuba part of Russia. They weren't going to institute the language. They weren't going to put the institutions there. The Russian government wasn't going to set up shop in Cuba. They were an ally or protectorate or something, as opposed to China, which literally wants to take over Taiwan. They figure these people are rogues, that they're disappearing. So I want to spend a little bit of time on the World War history of how Taiwan came to be, and that might help folks understand. But it's just a couple things. The Cuban Missile Crisis was in 1962, and Kennedy was inaugurated January 20th, 1961, elected in the fall of 1960. So from 1961 to 1962 was about a year and a half. He didn't have a huge amount of time to build up a whole lot of missiles, so this had to have been begun during the Eisenhower years, and maybe even the Truman years, to build up these nuclear missiles, right?
It was begun in the Eisenhower years, and during the Eisenhower period, they were deploying Atlas, ICBMs. The Minuteman came online. The Minuteman came online under Kennedy, and Kennedy mm-hmm. put a lot of money into it. In order to get that 5-to-1 superiority, you know, the Soviets, they didn't have a lot of ICBMs at that point mm-hmm. because they'd been focusing on medium-range ballistic missiles and intermediate-range ballistic missiles.
Right.
You know, I think they might have had, a dozen or a couple of dozen of ICBMs. So, you know, by achieving 100, 125 ICBMs in the first couple of years, and Kennedy was able to do that. I mean, I think he deployed more than that during the first couple of years. And that's another thing that is worth remembering. It's mm-hmm. really when you look at how quickly we were able to build up and deploy military systems back then, the 60s. It's right. really quite astonishing what we were able to achieve in just a few years. Whole new systems that hadn't existed before. In a matter of just 2 years, you know, we were deploying, you know, hundreds of these highly sophisticated systems. And today, I mean, and the Pentagon itself admits this. I think it was Admiral Charles Richard, who is the chairman of STRATCOM, who's looking at those 400 ICBM silos that China has built that we discovered mm-hmm. over the summer, okay? And they are building them with an astonishing speed. It's almost like, you know, like the Chinese system is able to do what our system was able to do back in the 1960s, before we had all this Pentagon bureaucracy that makes it take over a decade before you can build, you know, substantial numbers of a new system. And then at huge cost overruns, you know, there are just internal problems that we've created in the research, development, and procurement process in our military systems that has really hamstrung us.
Well, I mean, you got environmental impact statements you didn't have in the 60s. I mean, there's a lot of different things. Yeah, you cut out for a second.
Yeah, to be
okay, you're back. Yeah.
Well, and our ability to field systems. This might be another dimension of the military-industrial complex that Eisenhower was warning about. Not only does it, you know, pose a political threat to us, but it doesn't even deliver, you know, the kind of national security, that one would hope to get out of it. Certainly, the military-industrial complex of Eisenhower's period, at least, was able to give us the ICBMs when we needed them. And now, you know, the best we can hope for, you know, this ground-based strategic deterrence, the Minuteman, the replacement for the Minuteman III, you know, the earliest we're going to...
Yep, you cut out again.
And built 400 ICBM styles.
Yeah, you might be in a bad area. We're losing a little bit of the conversation. In fact, you've cut out for a bit now. Are you back? Let's see if we get you back. Yep. Okay. So feel free to keep talking, and then we should be able to hear you soon. It might be a bad area or something like that. This is interesting. I want to explore a couple things with Dr. Pry. One, the idea that, Cuba was a big showpiece of our success, whereas Korea was not. And then our big show, you know, something that worked in Cuba. And then, of course, we got into Vietnam. So it's interesting how these things kind of swing back and forth. I'll ask Dr. Pry that when he comes back. Dr. Pry, we still can't hear you. So keep trying. As soon as you get back in a decent area, we'll get going. The other thing I was curious about.
Can you hear me?
You
can you hear me?
Now you're back. Now you're back. Okay, good. So
good.
Korea, Cuba, Vietnam, do you see connections that things kind of stalemated in Korea, which might have emboldened the Russians to move to Cuba, and then our success in Cuba might have emboldened us to do something what I thought was pretty stupid in Vietnam. So do you see connections with those at all?
Can you repeat that question?
Sure. So the idea is that if you're following history, Korea, I mean, we came off World War II winning, I mean, hugely. And then within a few years, we were in, all of a sudden, now we're back in Korea. Well, Korea didn't go so well. Korea ended up a stalemate. It still hasn't officially ended. So that didn't look so good. So the Russians might have been emboldened by what happened in Korea to think, well, okay, well, we can set up missiles in Cuba. The United States is not the World War II United States, the Korea United States now. They've disarmed. And then we had great success in Cuba, you know, because we had the superior arms, superior missiles. So then we thought, well, we can do that. We can stop communism wherever we want. Let's go into Vietnam and stop it there. And, of course, things bogged down again. And it seems like the pendulum swings back and forth, you know, with these different campaigns that can go on for decades, you know, but some are short term, some are long term, but the one-upmanship sort of, but do you see a connection between from World War II to Korea, from Korea to Cuba, from Cuba to Vietnam, just those four?
Well, yeah, I think you can draw some inferences and some connections from that.
Okay.
You know, we describe today the Korean War as a stalemate, you know, but a lot of Americans and the communist bloc saw it as a victory for the other side.
Okay.
That it was actually a victory. And there's some good reasons for that. They weren't fighting just the United States. They were fighting the United Nations. So they were fighting the whole free world. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And under MacArthur, you know, we had actually gotten all the way to the Yalu River, you know, so that we'd captured North Korea. But then the intervention by China, pushed this back. So what would have been a classical victory a la World War II, you know,
right,
which is where we stood when we stood on the Yalu River, was denied us, you know. And so that the existence of a communist regime in North Korea was a huge victory for, you know, for the Soviet Union and for China. They had fought us to at best the draw, if you want to call it that, and they had nearly won the war in the beginning, you know, because our tanks, you know, couldn't stand up to the T-34s. And, you know, they pushed us all the way down into the Busan pocket, which is way back, you know, it's very tip of the Korean, mm-hmm. of the Korean Peninsula. So that was, that certainly would have encouraged them. In a way, it showed the United States was far from invincible. You know, we had allowed our military forces to, there was a huge build down of our military forces. You know,
right.
We did not have the army we had in World War II anymore. And that showed in Korea, you know, it really took, North Korea was, I mean, the Korean War wasn't a sideshow. You know, we had to put everything we had into it in order to achieve a stalemate. Okay. And so these guys are thinking, well, wow, what's going to happen if we decided to invade NATO Europe? Right. And they couldn't walked over NATO Europe at that time, which is why, you know, we put tactical nuclear weapons to try to deter them. And that's why there was this Europe arms race going on, a nuclear arms race going on in Europe over short range, medium range, and intermediate range missiles, which the Soviets basically were winning there, you know, winning big time in terms of the nuclear balance in Europe, you know, because that was really the only way we could defend Europe was with the nuclear weapons. I think we must also not forget Kennedy's embarrassment over the Gary Powers and the U-2 spy plane that got shot down.
When was
that?
So put it in perspective. I remember it, but when was it?
Yeah, that was prior to the, I think it was 1961, but it was
so
prior
before the Bay
to
Pigs.
Right.
Okay.
And they felt, and Khrushchev thought he had, that this was an example of Kennedy being that combined with the failure of the Bay of Pigs. These two blunders, these two embarrassments, Khrushchev thought he had Kennedy's number, that he was a young, inexperienced president and not very competent. And so this certainly encouraged them going into Cuba and the resulting confrontation that happened there. As to our involvement in Vietnam, you know, that had to do with Kennedy and more to do with Lyndon Johnson when he came in, you know, Pentagon, you know, Europe, we're endlessly familiar with the domino theory, which I believe ended up working out, you know, that we certainly lost Laos and Cambodia to communism as well as South Vietnam, you know, when that happened. So, so there are connectivities between these things. They're probably much more complex than we can discuss here in the next half hour. But there are, there are certainly connections to these. You know, the Soviet Union, communists, at least their adversaries, draw these connections. I'm not sure our own people are smart enough, at least these days, to draw connections like that and to think about, oh, well, how is this going to impact, for example, the debacle in Afghanistan? I mean, I sure hope that the Pentagon understands that the Afghanistan is more than just an isolated case, in terms of our credibility, that it has huge implications for our credibility loss all across the world with our allies and with our adversaries. So
we're calling it withdrawal, and I call it a surrender. They're not even using the right terms. They haven't come to terms with what actually happened there. There's been no call to get our weapons back or destroy the ones that are there. There's been no screaming to get our Americans back. There's been no call to take the Afghanis that shouldn't be here in the first place back to Afghanistan. So the mistakes were made so badly, but the thing is there's been nothing done to fix them. No attempts by either the gelding GOP or the Marxist Democrats. Nobody's trying to fix this situation. They're just accepting that it was a horrible situation and sitting around complaining about it. This is ridiculously unrealistic that we can continue not only – I mean, the first mistake was having it happen. The second mistake was letting it go on, at least letting it go
on,
do something about it. But no one's doing anything about it. Pianki, did you want to get on this?
No.
Yeah,
I wanted to do it.
All right. Let's stick it to Dr. Pry's answer first, then I'll take you, Pianki. Dr. Pry?
No, I certainly agree with you, Greg. It should be called the Afghanistan Surrender. obviously, right. For political reasons, the administration doesn't want to characterize it as such.
Yeah. But the Republicans can. Gutless geldings. Pianki, why don't you jump into
this? Yeah, I agree
Gene,
with Peter. I agree with Peter. At the World War II, there was a scale back, which became evident with the Korean conflict, but also in the Vietnam War, you seen where the political body didn't have the guts, didn't have the fortitude, like we seen with the political body in World War II. So now Afghanistan is showing the continuation of the slide. When will it stop?
Good question. Dr. Pry?
Yeah. I think, a phenomena that happened, a really important phenomena that happened after the Korean War. Well, I think it was even starting to go on with the Korean War, but mostly it happened in the Kennedy administration. This concept of the best and the brightest. The Kennedy administration brought into the National Security Council and into the Department of Defense a lot of academics and people from corporate America, like Robert McNamara, for example, who was the chairman of the Ford Foundation, right, and was, an Ivy League educated and all the rest. You know, he had not been a general. He didn't have a lot of combat experience. Prior to the Kennedy administration, when you looked at people who served as the Secretary of the Air Force or on the National Security Council staff, they were usually veterans. They usually were military people with military backgrounds, and they thought in terms of classical military theory, in terms of victory and defeat and the like. But with the rise of the theory of arms control, it should perhaps be called the religion of arms control, which was developed in academia. People said, the academics said, the introduction of nuclear weapons into the equation has changed everything. War is now more important. It's too important to be left to the generals. War is too important to be left to the generals. We need to think more comprehensively, to avoid nuclear war. And so this concept of fighting wars without achieving a victory. The object was to demonstrate our credibility, but not push the other side so far that you would end up getting into a nuclear war, which is one of the reasons we lost Vietnam. It actually had to do with the fear of it escalating the way the Korean War had escalated, so that we would end up in a nuclear war with China. My senility is such, I wish I could remember his name. Roger Swearingen. He was one of my mentors when I was working on my degree in strategic studies, and he had been an advisor to Lyndon Johnson. Swearingen remembers the moment, what he describes as the moment that he thought the Vietnam War was lost. Swearingen, who was an expert on China, was trying to tell Lyndon Johnson that, look, you can invade North Vietnam. You can invade North Vietnam. It's not like North Korea. The Vietnamese and the Chinese hate each other. China is not going to intervene if we go in with conventional forces and take over North Vietnam. Johnson didn't believe it and was deterred from doing that by the Chinese nuclear threat. And so that's why we fought Vietnam the way we did and left them with a safe haven. So our defeat was inevitable. But this idea that came out of academia that, wars are now too important for the generals. We need former Harvard professors, okay, who are steeped in arms control theory, to advise the Pentagon and even dominate the strategy in the councils of the National Security Council. And that's why we don't fight wars like we fought World War II anymore. And we were supposed to have learned that lesson post-Vietnam, by the way. We were supposed to have gone back to fighting the way wars, that you don't get involved in a war unless you're going to fight it to win. The war should be quick. We should bring the maximum force to bear. I mean, that's just classical military theory. That's what we were supposed to do in the aftermath, but we haven't done it. We never have learned the lesson. We're back to we're back to the thinking that lost us the Vietnam War in all of these wars in the Middle East and Afghanistan. You know, that one of the reasons we've been in Afghanistan, you know, is because of the concerns about Pakistan getting taken over by radical Islamists. And so that has just, and yet at the same time, we don't want to offend our Pakistan allies by invading the safe havens in Pakistan, where they were harboring the Taliban. I mean, it's the same mentality, the same kind of operating assumptions that lost us the Vietnam War.
Managed warfare doesn't work. If you're not going to engage in total war with overwhelming force and a good exit strategy, don't go into it in the first place. If you're so concerned that it might the war you're starting actually escalate into a bigger war, don't start the smaller war. You know, we're better off doing it at all than going in half-heartedly and trying to manage the war with these limitations. If you're afraid of the enemy, you don't go to war with an enemy you're afraid with. You go to war with an enemy you know you can defeat. That's the whole point.
Right. And another mistake we've made, you know, that departs from classical military theory is that, you know, you let your allies carry the burden, you know, whenever you can. You know, you don't take the whole responsibility on yourself and fight all the wars all by yourself. You know, if you've got if stakes are that important to regional stability, then you must have allies. I mean, the proof of that should be that you have allies in the region who should be willing, like Pakistan, for example, you know, itself, to get involved in the war and put down the war. And that's a wise policy, too, because your allies usually have a better understanding of the local situation, you know, of just who is the enemy, what is the, you know, let them handle it. They live in the neighborhood. They're more expert than you. But you know, if you're educated at Harvard and you're on the National Security Council, you think you know everything. And that's, I think that's basically where we've gotten, that they're going to do the thinking. They know better than the Pakistanis. They knew better than people in Vietnam itself. And, you know, they're going to manage the war because they're so brilliant. And,
they have a degree in arrogance.
They don't even have any background. Right.
That's fascinating.
They don't even have any background, you know?
Yeah.
And
I want to get to Taiwan before I get too far, because I don't really want to cover that a little bit. We've got about 17, 18 minutes left.
I want to go back to a point that you were making, though.
Oh, sure. Okay.
Before we lose this, because I think that we may be making a big miscalculation where Taiwan is concerned. All right.
Okay.
You were making the point, about having to understand where did the Taiwan problem come from, you know, and it makes it enormously different. A different situation here with Cuba, you know, because the Taiwan, most Americans know it anymore because we've stopped calling them the Republic of Korea, but that's what their government calls itself. They call themselves the Republic of Korea. And
China.
Why is that?
I think you mean China.
Well, that's right. They're not the People's Republic of China. Taiwan is the Republic of Korea. So you've got the People's Republic of China, which is Communist China, and the Republic of China, which is the Free China, as it were.
Right.
And that came about in what's called in the history books the Year of Shocks, 1949. And one of the big shocks that happened in 1949 is the nationalist Chinese, the so-called Free Chinese, lost the Civil War. Chiang Kai-shek lost the Civil War to Mao Zedong, and they had to retreat to Taiwan.
Right.
And where they could defend themselves. We didn't expect that to happen. Our big brains and the State Department and all the rest were surprised, shocked by that, because we thought that the free forces of freedom, the Chiang Kai-shek's forces, would win. But they didn't. So Communist China, you know, sees Taiwan as their property. They see the government of Taiwan is illegal, as illegal rebels, an illegal possession of territory that belongs to Communist China. And from Beijing's paranoid perspective, Taiwan poses an existential threat to them. This is because the Republic of Korea sees communist China as illegal and illegitimate. And, you know, they believe they're the legitimate government of China and often say so, you know. So communist China is concerned that the United States and allies, you know, might, you know, invade China sometime and try to replace the communist Chinese government with the Republican of Korea and restore the nationalist government to China, or that that Taiwan can be used as a base to foment revolution, you know, within China. This is a situation that didn't exist between the United States and Cuba, you know, in the 60s or ever. I mean, there was never any prospect of Cuba fomenting a communist revolution in the United States or of invading with its ally in the Soviet Union, of invading the United States and taking us over. But this is a threat that's taken very seriously by communist China. So communist China's stakes, its ideological stakes and its geostrategic stakes for reconquering Taiwan are much higher than our stakes were for keeping communism out of Cuba. And yet, even though our stakes were lower, we did attempt to invade Taiwan and kick communism out of Cuba. For, you know, I think it shows that there's the incentives for China to conquer Taiwan are so great that it's almost I'd say if any war was going to be inevitable, this is probably one of them, you know, because they have aspirations to be a global imperial power. In fact, they are becoming a global imperial power through soft power, the Belt and Road Initiative, and through hard power by having a military presence scattered throughout the globe. And no imperial system that aspires to global domination can tolerate something like a Taiwan in their own backyard. It shows weakness, you know. They basically, the ownership of Taiwan is a symbolic and practical manifestation of who's going to own the future. Is it going to be China, or is it going to be, you know, the United States and the free world and the allies of Taiwan? And there are very pragmatic strategic, geostrategic considerations as well from China's point of view. You know, they need Taiwan as an unsinkable aircraft carrier to complete. They're so eager to turn the South China Sea into China's territory, that they're actually building artificial islands so that they can have air bases and missile bases out in the South China Sea. But here Taiwan is, you know, this huge unsinkable aircraft carrier. When you look at where it is located in the South China Sea on the map, it's really indispensable to China's long-term defense, you know, to push America's ability to project power far back from their shores so that we would not be able to attack them with aircraft carrier groups. And at the same time, it would enable them to project power far to the Pacific so that they will become the dominant power there. So all of these factors exist, which didn't exist with Cuba for the United States. You know, Cuba, for any geostrategic, you know, reasons that are nearly as compelling as China's desire to have Taiwan. So when we think about, well, we need to invade, you know, we need to come to the defense of Taiwan and get into war with China to defend Taiwan at a time when we, you know, when our nuclear deterrent is inadequate and our conventional forces, I mean, every war game that we have shows that we lose in the contest with China. You know, this is not a smart thing, you know. Unfortunately, we've put ourselves in a situation where the choices are, you know, for us under a Biden administration, are either to just stand back and let China take Taiwan, which would be catastrophic, you know, for our credibility as a security guarantor of anybody, or to engage in a losing war against China, which would be even more catastrophic, you know, to actually fight the war and then lose it. And it might even escalate to a nuclear war, which would, you know, be an existential threat to our very existence. Dilemma we have. Sorry.
Yeah, and I question how much war there would actually be. First of all, do we have a base on Taiwan? Do we have any military bases on Taiwan?
No, we don't have any. There are no U.S. military bases in Taiwan. But recently, it was it's been in the press that we do have a military presence in Taiwan. We've had a clandestine.
Oh.
It's now come out that we've had a clandestine military presence. We've got defense contractors and military specialists trying to help the Taiwanese learn how to use our more sophisticated equipment and so that they can better defend themselves. This just came out in the press, I think, last week, you know, that we've had this clandestine military presence in there for, I think, a couple of years. And the Chinese, of course, are furious about it.
Well, we don't care. The last thing I worry about China. Like I said, I don't do managed war. I just do. I'm much more of a direct kind of person. Does Taiwan have nuclear weapons? And should they?
No. Taiwan doesn't have nuclear weapons, and we stopped their nuclear program. If I were the Taiwanese, yes, they. It's the only way they can guarantee their own security. And unfortunately, the way the world is going. And I think it's showing that the world order led by the United States since 1945, where we serve as the global policeman, is unraveling. Even the Japanese are talking about getting nuclear weapons. Japan is talking about nuclear weapons. There's a faction in South Korea talking about nuclear weapons. And maybe we shouldn't stand in their way. If we can't protect these countries,
I don't think
so. We shouldn't be making false promises to them that we're going to defend them, you know. One of the things that has come out of arms control, the academic arms control theory, is that one of the worst things in the world is nuclear proliferation. And so we have always tried to stop our allies from getting nuclear weapons. You know, we didn't approve of the Brits, for example, getting nuclear weapons, but we couldn't stop them. They wanted their own independent nuclear deterrent. Same thing with the French. You know, we didn't like the idea of an independent French nuclear deterrent. The French actually made this argument back in the 60s, saying, you know, everybody shouldn't be depending on the United States. How do we know you guys are going to be a reliable ally in the long term? The globe is made up of nations, and every nation, you know, owes it to itself to provide for its own security. And since nuclear weapons are the lead cutting-edge nuclear military technology of the day, you know, those nations which feel threatened, you know, need to get their own nuclear weapons. That was the a French theory, and it might be coming true. It might be coming true.
I agree with that because we're not going to defend these nations, and it's not up to us. We are not the world's police force, and the idea that we have to defend all these other nations with our nuclear weapons, with entanglements that we probably don't want to have anything to do with, you know, if Russia has nukes and China has nukes and Pakistan has nukes and India has nukes, and all these, well, India is probably a bad example, but countries that are not our allies have nukes. The idea we're denying our allies nukes, you know, because we don't want nuclear proliferation and all these other countries have nukes makes no sense. I would be much happier with Japan and Taiwan having nukes than China and North Korea having them, quite frankly.
I agree with you.
Let's balance the power. Maybe that'll stop.
I agree with you.
I would give them
classical balance of power theory. Now, of course, I also do think it's true that when you increase the number of nuclear weapon states, you are increasing the possibility of nuclear wars. You know,
but we don't control that anyway.
We
can't control that anyway. We can't control conventional.
Yeah, we can't. Right. Most academics think that they can, and it's the job of the United States to do that, you know, to run the rest of it. But the way things are unraveling, another thought on this is that it may be too little too late, you know, Japan and South Korea to be able to get these programs. And
we can loan them. Do we have a nuke loaning program? I mean, remember Lend-Lease in World War II? We lent all this stuff to Russia, and Britain did too, like hurricanes and things like that. Why don't we have like a nuke library card? You know, we just lend them some nukes for a while.
Well, you're reading my mind. You're reading my mind.
Please elaborate. Go ahead.
One of the things we're doing, for example, we want to develop this SLCM, sub-launch cruise missile. The Democrats are against it, but it's a tactical nuclear cruise missile, so that we could have a presence in Asia Pacific, you know, that's more credible. you know, constantly threatening North Korea. But what's going to be more credible than North Korea, South Korea or Japan or Taiwan having its own nuclear weapons, right?
Yeah.
That's going to be far more credible. I mean,
they're not going to use them offensively.
It always comes down to the
they're not going
to
attack anybody with
the
nuclear weapons. I'm sorry, go ahead.
You know, would the United States really be willing to get into a nuclear war to save Taiwan or South Korea or Japan? You know, hopefully, you know, maybe Joe Biden would, but I think a rational president, I pray God that they wouldn't. You know, the Constitution is to provide for the common defense of the American people. We're not to sacrifice them for the sovereignty of some other country. If these countries want to take on the burden of and the risk of nuclear weapons, well, good. You know, there are too many people in Washington who have been fond of what you might call Pax Americana, you know, the American empire. And they don't want to see that recede. But they never seem to consider the risk that we run to our existence as a country. There was a time when perhaps we could have afforded that because of our wealth and because of the modernity and strength of our nuclear and conventional forces.
That's arrogance,
that's
though.
That's a time that's way in the past.
That's arrogance.
One of the things I point out in my one of the things I point out in my article is, you know, when China they're talking about China completing these, putting the DF-41s in these 400 ICBM silos in several years. That's a few years. Is a few years, okay?
Mm-hmm.
That's 4,000 warheads. 4,000, all right? You know, we had a 5-to-1 advantage in ICBMs over the Soviet Union during the Cuban Missile Crisis. That would give China a 10-to-1 advantage in us over our ICBMs and almost a 3-to-1 advantage in our overall nuclear forces. And we're nowhere near being able to come up to compete with that. It's just incredible arrogance to think that the numbers don't matter and it's not going to make a difference and that we can defend Taiwan and South Korea and Japan against, you know, a nuclear-armed communist giant. And not only that, but another thing that we pointed out, I mean, we're going to run out of time here, but Kennedy didn't face a coalition of nuclear powers in 1962. You know, Russia, North Korea, and China are allied. They are a coalition of nuclear powers. We're going to have to face not just China, but all three of these nuclear superpowers. Anybody who's got a nuclear arsenal becomes a superpower in my book. And, that's a situation Kennedy didn't face. For us to think that we're going to be able to prevail, you know, under those circumstances that are when the balance is so lopsided against us is really the kind of thinking that gave us Afghanistan and that gave us defeat in the Vietnam War, you know.
Yeah.
And except the stakes are much higher this time because the survival of the homeland is at stake, you know.
Well, it's interesting. The parallel that you made between Cuba and Korea really comes true because if we have basically a rent-a-nuke program where we're actually supplying Taiwan with nuclear weapons, we would be doing exactly what Russia was doing to Cuba right off our border. We'd be supplying Taiwan with nuclear weapons right off their border. And I don't think Taiwan would ever use them offensively. I don't think Japan would. You know, maybe in the bygone day when the emperor and they were a feudal society, sure. But given where Japan is right now with their constitution and given where Taiwan is now with their republic, I don't see them ever using nuclear weapons offensively. So the idea of giving them to them, you know, is a great idea. So in the 2 minutes we have left, I got one more question. Pianki and Gene, if you want to hop in, feel free. But what I want to ask is how many nuclear weapons do you think would provide enough of a deterrent that China would consider it unacceptable to invade Taiwan? How much of a nuclear force do you think they would need? And what kind of nuclear weapons?
Oh,
I only have 2 minutes.
Well,
yeah. Tough question.
That's
I know.
a tough
We can do
question.
It next week.
You know, because they can do things like a super EMP attack to neutralize those weapons. But the point is, you know, that the weapons in the actual in the possession of Taiwan or South Korea or Japan will have much greater credibility. You know, a few nuclear weapons will have much greater credibility as a deterrent than, you know, thousands of U.S. nuclear weapons, you know, because there's going to be that question.
Okay.
And the answer to the question is obvious to a reasonable person that the United States shouldn't be willing to trade, you know, Chicago for Taipei, you know.
But Taipei should be able to defend Taipei. they should be
however
able to
many
their own
or however few,
yeah.
however many or however few you have to put in Taiwan, you know, mm-hmm. even a single nuclear weapon, I think, is gonna have much greater credibility, you know, because for all, the other thing, for Taiwan to lose its sovereignty, or South Korea to lose its sovereignty, or Japan to lose its sovereignty, that's an mm-hmm. existential threat for them, you know.
Yeah.
So if you're going to go to war against one of those countries, they may well be willing to strike your cities, you know. So they might actually be able to get away with something like a minimum deterrent, enough to destroy, you know, with hundreds of nuclear weapons that are capable of doing massive damage to Chinese cities. I agree with you that Japan and South Korea and Taiwan, that the free nations would not use them offensively, you know. You know, but the mere presence of at least a minimum deterrent, you know,
yep.
Might be enough to make the threat unacceptably high, because they'd have to guarantee that they could get all of those weapons, because you know, they're basically snuffing out the life of this nation state, and they have nothing left to lose, you know, by massive retaliation against China's homeland.
I have to hold you there. We're out of time. This has been fascinating, but I think it's a good question for us to pick up next week. Pianki, Jean, thank you very much. Dr. Pry, thank you so much. Let's hold it right here, because we're out of time, and then we'll pick it up next week. But this is a fascinating question, and this goes for any nation. How much of a nuclear deterrent is enough so that you don't have a massive force where you can actually win a huge nuclear war, but enough to create enough of damage that it's just not worth, you know, a nation going to attack you like China and Taiwan? Thank you, sir. Thank you, everybody, for listening. This is Greg Penglis for Action Radio at blogtalkradio.com/citizenaction. Back tomorrow morning, 7 o'clock Eastern, 6 o'clock Central Time.
Have a good day. Bye.
Thanks, Gene.
Thanks. Bye-bye. Thank you.
Bye now.